Live from the Film Grok Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City, it's Film Grok. And now, Serge Del Pierre.
I thought you were going to say something.
I just kept it clean. This time I just went simple.
That's right. And we already have the theme music up at the top, so it's kind of topsy-turvy. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for joining us at Film Grok. My name is Serge Del Pierre. Our movie for this week is True Romance, just in time for Valentine's Day. What a great Valentine's Day movie.
It is.
Today, it says romance.
It does. And it's true romance, not false romance or fake romance. That's right.
I like false romance myself.
It's not like true. It's not like true. You know, it's not like true love either. It's true romance.
Mm. Yes. Well, we don't want to, you know, overstep love. You know.
Well, I think it's better. And we have with us here today. We have
Duncan K. Fraser
and
Jim Usterman.
And joining us for the first time is
Taylor Thomas.
Hi, Taylor. Welcome.
Hi.
To Film Grok.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Our cue point for True Romance is, we actually have a cue point for this one, because we went through a whole run of them with the Planet of the Apes films where they're like, there's no cue point.
And we strangely put together.
It was a kind of early 70s type of thing where for a while they just started like cold right up at the front.
Oh, yeah.
And they just go into it like no logos or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was a directorial choice?
I'm trying to do the cue point.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'm just curious. I'm taking us back to other films.
The cue point for True Romance is at the end of the Morgan Creek logo. And as soon as it fades to black, pause it there. And so we're just going to, while you do that, we're going to talk a little bit. But once we're ready, we'll count down 3, 2, 1, play. And then we'll hit play. And hopefully you'll hit play. And then you can listen to our commentary while you're watching the movie. Or you can listen to the commentary while you're doing something else, like you're doing your homework or
surgery.
Ooh, that's a good one. I've never heard that
before. That is good.
Yeah, you know what? I could see that in operating rooms. Hey, let's listen to some Film Grok commentaries.
It really helps me concentrate.
Hand
me the cauterizer.
That's right. I disagree with what Sarah's just saying right now. Oh, what did I just do? Okay.
Yeah. Get that heart monitor off that. Yeah, I want to see the film.
We need a good surgery commentary to do, like coma or something like that.
Coma's good.
Coma, like, disappeared. You ever heard of Coma?
No, I have not.
You ever heard of Coma? It was a movie from the late 70s. It was based on a book by a guy named Robin Cook, and it was actually directed by Michael Crichton. I think it might have been second film. Westworld was his first one.
Also good.
I think. Yeah, Westworld should be done.
Awesome.
And it was with Michael Douglas and Jean-Jean Bujold. Oh, yeah.
You speak French names beautifully.
That's because
Del Pierre.
Del Pierre's my name.
Serge.
That's right.
It's like from Beverly Hills Cop, right?
No.
Hello, my name is Serge.
I have a quick story to say about that. When I visited some cousins back in the early 90s in France, I was talking to them in French, and I was asking them, because they were basically illusionists, and I asked them if they knew David Copperfield.
Really?
So I'm saying, you know, talking French. French accent.
You come from French carny folk?
Let me finish the story.
Sorry.
Let me finish the story. So we're talking, blah, 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 je parle français, David Copperfield, okay, whatever. And they're looking at me, they have no idea what I'm talking about, and we continue on for like a half an hour or whatever, and then at some point they say, blah, 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 David Copperfield. I say, David Copperfield. They go, oh, oui, David Copperfield. We know, you know, we know who that is.
Why did you speak so strangely?
It was completely the accent that, with the accent, they didn't understand
David
the name David Copperfield. They're looking at me like I'm an alien.
David Copperfield.
David Copperfield. Literally. It was that much difference between that and David Copperfield. And, I mean, that's culture for you, so.
Mm-hmm. Your circus folk may be a little simple.
Hey, big time illusionists. They ain't no simple folks. So.
I like it when we insult Serge's family right off.
Yeah, well, you know, you can take pokes at mine too. There, but it's kind of like poking,
this is my,
you know,
house.
Handicapped folk.
Great. You don't have any illusionists in your family?
Well, depends on your definition of the word.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe we should talk about the movie.
Let's do that.
That's right. Taylor, since it's your first... Oh, you know, before started, actually... Wait, Duncan has asked that we start a tradition here, so we're going to try this. Duncan has a fortune cookie that he brought in, and he basically said, let's bring it in and open it on air And then whatever the fortune is will essentially somehow mystically and magically evoke the theme of the film.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so it will be the fortune for the film, whatever it means.
It will be
to
for the fortune
audience.
For the film, for whatever it means.
Yes.
And so we have not looked at it. I swear, no. Cookies and...
We must all of us speaking partake.
And we have to partake
first.
Of the cookie. Okay. Start taking your pieces, which are already there. Okay. Should I read it now or should I read it once we're ready?
I think after.
Oh.
Oh, come on. Get your get
no,
your
come on.
Ready.
I want to think about it. I need to think about the fortune, so read it now.
The maybe fortune. In the interest of time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do this, Taylor. Really, we're not this strange.
Okay, thank
yeah,
you.
No, really, we are.
Okay. All right, so the fortune reads. Let's see. Okay. An empty stomach is not a good political advisor. So
that's
say,
what it says.
You better have
really?
Some cookie, Taylor.
An empty stomach is not a good political advisor.
No, right?
So say we all. All right.
So say we all.
Yeah, fun
Amen.
Stuff here. Okay, so Taylor, can
yes.
you please tell us about the first time you saw True Romance?
The first time I saw True Romance. Well,
the movie, by the way.
Yes.
Was it love at first sight?
Important point.
It was. Well, see, my dad had this huge collection of movies I couldn't see.
That is perfect.
I have that collection.
Yes.
Jim,
that came out really wrong.
You have movies that Taylor can't see? That's weird, dude.
When I was, and so I saw this movie way too young because I went and took it because I really wanted to see it.
Oh.
I watched it really late at night.
Ooh, how old were you?
Wow.
I was like 12, maybe.
Oh, that's, my Lord.
That's not that young.
But it's I wasn't allowed traumatic. To see it.
Hey, in ancient Verona, you would have been married at 12.
Yes, I would have.
See?
Yes. But I watched it because I was really a big fan of Gary Oldman and Christopher Walken. That's the main reason why I watched that movie.
Oh. Not for Christian Slater.
No.
Really?
No.
Oh, there's no love for Christian Slater with you?
I mean, he's all right.
No true confessions here, apparently.
Man, I think a 12-year-old, you'd be like, oh, he's dreamy.
No Heathers for
no,
you?
It's Gary Oldman.
No.
Oh, he's dreamy.
It was Gary Oldman.
You were kind of a twisted little 12-year-old.
Yeah, I saw Dracula way too young.
That was a good film, by the way.
Very sexy.
Mm-hmm. So you saw it and you liked it?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
And there you have it.
Okay. Dead space.
Good story.
Jim.
Yeah.
Jim.
Yes, sir.
First time you saw True Romance.
I actually have. I've seen True Romance twice and not in many, many years. And I can't recall what the occasion was when I did see it, but I liked the movie. I mean,
okay. All right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't have any.
Oh, actually, while we're getting ready to go in just a second, while we're spooling up the film on the Film Grok projector, this is going to be the what they call the director's cut, featuring footage not seen in theaters! Exclamation point. So this would include the scene with Drexel at the beginning with the Sam Jackson scene, and also just some modifications in the last final big shootout, which we'll talk about too. But just so you guys know, this, and I think this is the only one that's really available. I got this DVD in the late 90s, so I don't think they even issue the other one anymore.
Someone at home is scrambling to their Netflix right now.
Oh, yeah, good luck on that one.
Good luck queuing it up.
Yeah,
really. Oh, darn, I have the other one. I have the VHS. Oh.
1993.
Yeah, it was 1993. VHS was full swing. DVD was just a glimmer in someone's eye. Duncan, your first time seeing this.
That was an interesting illusion.
It was.
Was maybe...
Beta was dead.
Right? I maybe saw this for the first time like 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
My roommate Nathan...
three?
Made me watch it. Yeah.
Wow.
In 2008?
Yeah, or seven. Wow. Something like that. There are many movies that my roommate has enticed me to watch. Some of them are good, like this one. Some of them are like, you know, Beer Fest. So it's
yeah.
kind of that's a film classic right there.
This is not Beer Fest.
No, this is definitely not Beer Fest. And I liked it. Like I don't usually watch maybe edgy things. And also, I grew up in Kentucky, and so I
edgy enough.
And in a Christian culture, so basically I was not. My film viewing choices were more limited. I did see a lot of, you know, Schwarzenegger films and some different things like that. But certainly not something like an edgy drama kind of thing like this. It just wasn't on my radar. So it wouldn't have been when it came out when I was in high school. It was only later that I got into film and then, you know, opened my mind to viewing all kinds of different films. And I'm glad I watched this one.
It's interesting that you consider it an edgy kind of drama. I saw it when it first came out. I can't honestly tell you whether I saw this in the movies or if I saw it on videotape, but I definitely saw it back then. And I think I saw it before I saw Reservoir Dogs. Now, in terms of the chronology of what came out, Reservoir Dogs, I think, came out first. And then I think this came out in 92. This came out in 93. Natural Born Killers came out in 94. And then Pulp Fiction was out in 94. But he had worked on, Quentin Tarantino had worked on this with Roger Avery before that. And this was the first script, the big script that they sold, was True Romance, which started off also as a, you know, it started off as the script. And then essentially in the script, Clarence was writing a script called Natural Born Killers, which they decided to then break off. I mean, I'm really simplifying a long story. And that's how they became those two things. And those two scripts sold. And of course, we know that, Oliver Stone made Natural Born Killers and Tony Scott did this. Whether this influenced, I don't remember. I didn't brush up on my Tarantinoology to really say if this influenced whether Reservoir Dogs was done or not. But I remember seeing this, and this was the first Quentin Tarantino film I'd ever seen. And I was really struck by the criminality of this guy. I'm like, what is going on? But also the way, you know, the way it treated violence, and I just thought it was interesting, which of course we see more in the films that he actually directed, where it really comes out. But already in the writing was just so, the writing was just so much different at the time in 93 than anything we were seeing. It was like really, really different. And when I watched it again yesterday, I was like, a lot of this has stood up. It's had a lot of imitators, and it's definitely diluted the value of it. But I was reminded of, this really stood out. I felt it stood out for me at the time, of what a characterization can do and what great characters were drawn in situations. And we'll get to that when we're watching the movie. But just like one key character point, which I just think you never see in movies, and I just think you see it so little, because I think movies for the most part are, shall I say, cowardly. And this one definitely is not cowardly.
No, I agree.
This one is kind of crazy, too, and I think that's the whole point.
And I think you're right about the writing. The writing was very different.
The writing was superior.
Yeah, and in seeing it, that was what struck me. When I saw it originally, was this is, I actually was a little confusing because I wasn't used to it, but it was very different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sort of convolution at the end, intentional convolution of the situation,
right,
was fantastic.
Well,
the
ending really was a mashing of genres, which was really good, which we hadn't really seen any of that,
right,
in American cinema, of course, which he pulled out and everyone keeps on trying to, and it still doesn't keep on working. Enemy of the State. Oh, that's right. Tony Scott directed that one, too.
Oh, dear.
Well, I worked for Enemy of the State. I just didn't like that movie too much, but okay.
Wait, you worked for the Enemy of the State?
I didn't work for the Enemy of the State. I saw a movie with Will Smith called Enemy of the State, which was shot in D.C., by the way.
Well, they really shot it there?
When I was living there, and I know someone who was an assistant to one of the producers at the time.
Fancy schmancy.
Big deal. I know. Exactly. All right. So on that point.
What were you doing in D.C.?
I was living in D.C.
I'm just to hear a little background on Sarah for our audience. What did you do in Washington?
None of your business.
Nanya.
That's right, Nanya.
None of your business.
I live there. What do you want? All that counts is I'm here in beautiful downtown Studio City doing film rock. And the audience goes a little crazy.
Right.
All right, the remote is in hand.
Stand by, ladies and gentlemen.
Ceremony remote is raised. Actually, I'm pointing to the film grok projectionist and going to give him the cue to start the film. And he's there in the booth. He's waiting impatiently, sipping on his Coke. Okay.
What's that guy's name?
Clarence.
Wow, coincidence.
Maybe not. Okay. Okay, countdown now. 3, 2, 1, play.
Roll 'em, Clarence.
Shouldn't it be Harvey, your invisible friend?
No. And this is... It's a song about Graceland, isn't it?
Well, he definitely said Graceland.
I don't know who it is. I should, but I don't. Anyway, the point is there is definitely a...
It's not Stray Cats, is it?
No, it's not Stray Cats.
I can't quite hear it, so...
What are you, Deef?
Deep or doom?
Here we go. Now, here with me, right off the bat, we have him talking about Elvis. And what were you saying about this before, Taylor?
Oh, in the original script where he died at the end?
Yeah.
Well, I just, when you hear him talk about Elvis in the beginning and he talks about how Elvis died young and he was a good looking corpse, I thought it was a much more poetic ending when he died at the end because he was a young good looking corpse. He fulfilled his dream of being like Elvis.
Yeah, he fulfilled his destiny. That's very interesting. Yeah, because, well, for anyone who doesn't know this, in the script, one of the major things they changed when they did it, one is they put it all in chronological order because it was not quite in chronological order. And then the end was much more bloody and violent, and Clarence does die, and Alabama shoots the cop point blank, which definitely got changed. There's a whole story back, you know, when this movie came out, oh, we couldn't do that. It's had to change the ending and all that kind of thing. And that goes back to the differences. Actually, when they did the director's cut, they actually changed it a little bit more. So now that Alabama does shoot the cop, but it's kind of like still in the heat of the battle as opposed to how it was in the script.
It was a little more cold-blooded.
So, yeah, definitely in the script it was more cold-blooded.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. This is great. I think Christian Slater does a really good job with Clarence. I mean, he really inhabits Clarence. He makes Clarence come to life, which is really cool. I can't think of anyone else doing Clarence, quite frankly.
No, I believe him when he's talking about Street Fighter, that he loves those movies and he goes and watches them all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
You got great pop references here right off the top of the...
Oh, I know. And I love that. She's basically trying to pick her up and trying to go to movies.
Inviting her to a triple feature of
Kung Fu movies. And she's just like, that. I don't think so. I think you're crazy. But she does a really good job with this. And actually, if you read the script, it's written... Her reaction is written a little differently than this, but she did great.
I would totally hit on a chick by inviting her to kung fu movies.
Of course,
that's how I roll.
Of course, she's really drunk too, but
which is why she clearly is, you know, saying no to a kung fu triple feature. I mean,
well,
why else?
I think also she's looking at him like, you're not my kind of guy who wants to go. You know, I don't want to go to a kung fu triple feature. Interesting point. This film takes place in Detroit, Motor City.
I forgot about that.
But actually, look at how alive that city looks.
Well, this is back in 93.
Yeah.
When it still had some life to it. And the cavalcade of stars who were in this is pretty incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, now, I forgot all of these people were in it.
I mean, the one thing, the one complaint I have about this film is it looks...
Speaking of...
Well, no, but it looks... Because the look is right now. It looks really... I mean, it's a Tony Scott film. It looks really... It looks slick. It looks shot the way he does with a lot of long lenses and definitely a lot of art direction and color.
Every
and
single
style.
Name they've had up here is someone you recognize.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Saul Rubinek.
Oh, my God. Now,
who played a lot of character parts. And James Gandolfini's in this.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he plays... plays two.
Is he one of the thugs?
He's yeah, he beats
Walken?
Up he's
one
of he's Alabama.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But Chris Penn, Tom Sizemore. Yeah.
Together on the same card, by the way.
Yeah, because they were in this.
That's a little terrifying.
Yeah.
They play
yeah.
together. But Chris Penn was in Reservoir Dogs. Mm-hmm. And Tom Sizemore was in Natural Born Killers.
Mm-hmm.
Playing Scagnetti. And he plays Scagnetti in this one, too?
Yeah, but they have different first names.
Is this like the whole Vic Vega, Vincent Vega and Vic Vega thing?
Hans Zimmer did the music.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Wow.
Hans Zimmer.
Actually, here, what they did is they gave her a voiceover. This is Alabama's voiceover. Now, in the script, the way it was originally written, what happened is the next scene is the scene with Drexel, which we're not going to see for another, 15 minutes, and then would continue on through after that. And then it came back in a flashback to what we're about to see right now. And then when they produced this, they kind of put it back in all in order.
They're kind of doing it with the voiceover, though, aren't they?
Well,
she's obviously referring to what happened
right,
previously.
But here, basically, what happened is the scene when they're with Dickie in the... in Los Angeles and saying, well, what's in the suitcase and why are you out here? And they said, well, Gauls goes back to this, and then they cut to this. But that's already after we've seen the whole thing with Drexel getting killed, with the father getting killed. I mean, the whole thing. And then they go back to explain how the whole story is. Now, I can kind of understand going into it here because this introduces us to their relationship, which is kind of core to the movie. I'm not saying it works better. It just works different. And I'm sure when they looked at it, I'm sure there were quite a few discussions. like the Sonny Chiba dialogue.
Awesome.
So, And of course, Rosanna Arquette.
Oh, man.
That was artful, rather artful on her part, actually.
Right.
Rosanna Arquette, of course, was in the TV show Medium for a number of years, for the past 7 years, which of course got canceled. But she was, obviously older than when she is here. So this is quite a...
I thought it was Patricia. Isn't that Patricia Arquette?
Did I just say Rosanna?
Yeah.
What is my problem? Okay, I gotta go get my brain washed. You're so right. It's Patricia Arquette. Let's start again. Rosanna Arquette was in Desperately Seeking Susan.
Yeah.
What happened to her?
I can't.
She had
all
that
the
song written about her.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's it. Once you have a song written, that's it.
Look at how nice she looks.
Oh, well, she was doing a whole bunch of stuff. She did Lost Highway for David Lynch.
She did
Lynch.
Do Lost Highway.
She was doing all these kind of things that were younger parts. This is probably her biggest part in terms of the younger parts. Anyway, when Patricia did Medium, I think she basically able to find, she kind of reinvented herself. And I think it was a really good show, actually. She did really well. But rather different than this film. Okay, can I complain about the smoking?
Sure. Do you need to?
Well, I don't think anyone's been able to smoke in a theater since the 50s.
Yeah,
it's
right?
Detroit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case. Now, I guess a question is, in looking at this, how much does the Tarantino-ness of the Tarantino script come through in this film for you? Because a lot of the dialogue they wrote in the script is still in the film. They didn't change very much of that. Mm-hmm. Just a few minor little things here and there.
She's downright dishy in this, though.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, but she was...
Well, in Medium, she was not.
Well, right. Medium, she's already in her, mid to late 30s. Here, she's in her mid-20s. Mm. 93? Yeah, I'd say mid to late 20s. Oh, we have the diner scene, though definitely not a Natural Born Killers or Pulp Fiction diner scene.
Mm-mm. No.
So, and even if you're watching the dialogue right now, all this dialogue is written in rhythms that we're still not used to hearing dialogue quite written like this, because for some reason a lot of people can't pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's where you really see Tarantino shine through in the script, is all the pop culture references and the rhythms, even though he's not directing it.
Right. But in terms of how his characters use dialogue,
yeah,
which I think is the difference, but also how they motivate themselves, where they come from. I mean, you're looking at a character like Clarence, the sugar. who is Clarence and what does he do? He works in a comic book shop. He's all into comic books. He's all into the imagination.
Quinton.
Mm-hmm. He worked. Mm-hmm. He didn't work in a comic shop. He worked in a
video store.
Yeah.
It's only because he couldn't get the job at the comic book store.
No, I'm sure he could have gotten a job at the comic book store. He definitely knows about it enough. So, but that's the interesting thing. I mean, it definitely taps into what people do as opposed to. What I want to call it, fantasy jobs in movies, for the most part.
Yeah. Well, Quentin himself has said this is his most autobiographical script.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's telling the truth or not.
He killed someone named Drexel?
Well, no, I just think putting himself into the character.
Well, no, absolutely. It was interesting because I was reading about the original script. I got at least through part of it, and I kind of felt that way, too. There's just some things he has them say. In terms of how you look at your life and that kind of thing, and just also the pop culture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that, And probably this is one of the first few films, because obviously with Reservoir Dogs too, but no, he was putting in pop, I mean, as much as everyone else, so hey, we should be doing this. He put pop cultural references into his work because it was part of the characters. It's not, it was just to do it to like, oh, it's cool, but like, these are interesting things. These are things that people are interested in. There are collectors, you know. Oh, this is interesting, the way they push in here. This is where she falls in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
She's just listening to him, and he's just, like, totally into his thing. And it's just, like, I really like that they did that Zoom, because I don't like Zooms unless they really mean something, and I think here means something.
This reminds me of Top Gun. And, doesn't it? It's a whole silhouette, like, slow kissing. And well, who, that doesn't, but, you know.
And who directed Top Gun?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
Tony Scott.
Was the one, oh, you're, Tony.
You're, I thought you meant, oh,
I thought you were being darned. Funny that you didn't, oh, remember. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, totally Top Gun.
Then it totally makes sense. Same artist. Yep. There we go. I love it that he's got an Elvis bust over on the side, like Elvis is watching or something.
I got to say, for a 90s love scene, this is probably one of the more tasteful ones.
Yeah.
Well, Tony Scott, because, I mean, Tony Scott, too, I mean, he was a stylist who was able to do that.
Besides, with the word romance in the title, you got to have some romance of some kind. Well, not just,
well,
you know,
well, that's the point.
Bang, bang, bang.
Well, yeah, exactly. But this, I mean, this is it for the film, really.
Oh, in terms of sex scenes?
Anything like this, yeah. This is it.
Well, that was sexy.
Well, you don't need that many if it means something and it forwards the plot, which really any scene should.
Right.
Whoa.
Okay, now the neon is a little too much. I'm sorry.
93.
I know.
That's how my bedroom looks. What are you saying?
Well, you got neon in your room? Who's got neon? I mean, neon, don't get me wrong, neon's cool.
Maybe really, black lights, but neon, but I mean, come on.
Who's got neon? Who has the time to go out, I want to get a blue neon sign and put it in my room?
Why would you get blue? Everybody looks dead.
Okay.
Because you like Blade Runner?
Oh, there you go.
That could be why.
That'd
could be why.
Yeah, that'd be a reason to get neon.
Yep.
See, blue neon?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And it would fit his character. Just saying. Just
here
saying.
Here it is. Wait, big reveal. Emotional.
Yes. A theater? What the hell is a chief theater checker?
And she throws herself from the billboard.
From the,
right?
Okay, now how many people live right off of a billboard, too?
Only the lucky ones.
In Detroit? I guess. I don't know. It's kind of a movie set type of thing. In the script, they're just in his place. They're not on, like, the outside of a billboard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of things, like where they're outside, or it's like kind of moved, the scenery's a little bit bigger. It usually happens in the smaller place. In reading this, I was thinking, you know, this might be a good play. You could actually maybe do this as a play. I was thinking Pulp Fiction could be done as a play, too, if you think about it. If you do it right.
Yeah, if you did it right.
You could do Pulp Fiction and True Romance as a play. They're that good. Because they have scenes, they have people talking to each other for longer than just, well, whatever. Half page, and it means something, and it's interesting.
That's romantic.
That's right. You're not a guy. I'm really happy.
That's a good start anyway, right?
Actually, that's not in the script. They did add that. So this is a little rewritten for the film. Wow.
I love the juxtaposition of the scene versus the music. Like, it's sort of leading you to, like, this is going to turn into something positive and good. It's well done.
I know, it's like really sweet music, and then it's just going to get
sweet,
really violent.
Happy, like, you know.
See, that's interesting, because I'm...
Very innocent sounding.
I don't really like the music. I mean, the music itself would be like, okay, but really juxtaposed against this, I'm like... I'd rather have different music or no music.
Yeah, I actually think I would too.
But I see what you're saying. it's kind of like it's right on the edge there. I feel it's like a Tony Scottization of this, to saying, hey, we're on a, I don't know, we're on an adventure, you know. But I'd rather have it without music, quite frankly. I don't know.
I kind of like the music. It's a little whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mind it if it came in a little later here.
It fits. Like it fits with the way it's shot.
Yeah,
I will totally agree. It fits with the way it's shot. I will give it that. If it was shot differently, I mean, here you got some really long lenses. I mean, it looks pretty as all get out. I just don't know if this film should be so pretty.
Well, if Quentin did it, you definitely would not be hearing this music right now.
and that's maybe my feeling is that now this, I don't know. I mean, you read the script, there is definitely an indie vibe to it, but not like a bad indie vibe. So I don't know. I mean, it depends. You could redo this film and do it a different way. Whatever way, you know, you can make things work in different ways. Plays get done all the time, and they get done different ways.
Yeah.
And they restaged. Work and they don't work. You can restage a film, and, you know, just so you can conceive a film in a different way. It's not just one way. I like that they're both wearing red.
Right. Very appropriate for our Valentine's Day broadcast.
That's right.
It is.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I like before what he was saying before, is that, you know, when she said, I'm just for you. And, you know, that was like the thing that made it, because in the script they kind of glide over that too. And she said, that's the thing. You know, he said, you're just for me? Fine. The matching tats. Great. Mm-hmm.
What's more romantic than that, man?
I guess. I'm not into tattoos. Sorry. these guys are crazy. See, this is interesting, because now that they're married, he starts getting this idea about Drexel in his head. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think the film just started taking off. And just like, and I think that's why I kind of like this better, doing it in here, because you start getting the idea. Look, if you start watching him, he's just getting this idea in his eyes. It's like an idea that starts invading his brain about Drexel.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this. And it just keeps on going. Now, okay, so now in the script, this is where this followed the first scene. I don't know. You have something like that.
You know what? I think I have seen this version,
that's
actually.
That's Sam Jackson. There he is.
I thought I hadn't seen this version, but yeah. He looks great in that. He makes that outfit look good.
This one?
He makes anything look good.
No, that's a good point. I like seeing Gary Oldman as just sort of a layabout. You know, he's a tough guy layabout, and he's in charge of some people.
Gary Oldman, still, that
amuses me.
He is awesome in this.
Oh, he's amazing.
When is he not good? Yeah. I love Gary Oldman.
He plays a guy who's basically, he's acting like he's black. And he's just so over the top and just so, it just fits so wrong, but he makes it work.
Yeah, he's not afraid to be really offensive, Gary Oldman. He just goes for it.
Yeah. Man. See? Okay. So now we know what he's up about. Now, and then just so you know, again, in the script, the original script, that fourth guy was not there. It was just Drexel with the other two guys, and the scene went on for like another two pages.
Interesting. What happened in the other two pages?
Oh, they talked more about sex and all this kind of thing, and it kind of made more sense about like why he shot them.
Oh.
Other than he was ripping them off, right. But...
And by the way, may I just add a gun note? And that's one of the few scenes I've ever seen where they actually fired the weapon the number of times they would have had shots for it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
See, this is where the idea is in Clarence's head, and it is burning. It is just like digging into his brain. Oh, is this the killer?
Ooh.
I think this
killers.
Is killers. I think this is the killer. That's Chow Yun-Fat. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is the killer.
Is it?
It was Replacement Killers?
No, The Killer.
No, The Killer.
John Woo's The Killer.
Oh, okay.
And
so,
now here, of course,
in Chinese.
This is where Elvis shows up, which, of course, in the movie, they couldn't call him Elvis.
No, it would be too expensive.
That's why you don't see him. He's credited as the king, and you know who plays him?
Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer, exactly.
Mm. He went through like 3 hours of makeup to turn into Elvis, and they never show him.
Oh, man.
Doesn't work as well.
Val Kilmer is a great actor.
He's a better ghost this way.
Oh, it works. They do it really well.
Yeah. Val Kilmer is a great. He doesn't get enough credit. He's
really great. But what's great about this is that how they just this whole idea. But Clarence is fucking crazy, man.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea has just gnawed into his brain, and now he's got Elvis in his head.
Well, what gets me is he's talking about being haunted by an idea of a guy when he's being haunted by freaking Elvis in his bathroom.
Exactly.
You know, mm-hmm. in his head.
Right. And now he's going to act on it. And this is what I think set this film apart from like anything else, because he's our protagonist and he's going to act on all this. And you know, of course, it's just him talking to himself
mm-hmm.
in his mind. You know? And now he's just determined. And the other part of it is that he has no fear. He's going to go in and do it. I mean, he goes mm-hmm. in knowing. He's got the envelope. It's empty. He knows exactly how it's going to go down. Well, he doesn't know exactly. He knows what the end game is going to be. He knows he's going to do it.
Right.
Which is, you never see a character do that. Ever. Except in Quentin Tarantino films. And maybe other lesser films which you've never heard of.
Well, he has his characters do what you always wish they would do in movies.
Right. That's a good way to put it, actually. I like that. You know, his characters do what you always think that you would do or you would want to do. Yeah.
And he motivates him. It's not mm-hmm. like he
yeah, it doesn't come out of nothing.
It's just out of nothing. That's why he has that. You saw the well, that had to do with the directing too, the directing and the acting, where they were building up to it there, and then in the bathroom, the whole thing with Elvis as it's not a motivation, but it's an expression of how his mind is working and how he can move through the moment so that he can actually motivate himself.
Right. It explains his motivation without just being a boring, you know, monologue in his head or something.
Exactly. Like yeah. And the great thing is that, you know, usually the second act starts because of something that happens to you. Second act here starts because this motherfucker actually goes out and changes it. He's actually doing it. He's the one who changes the story.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
He could have just left it alone. They could have just gone off on their way and everything would have been fine. It's like, no, I've got to act on this. And usually in a film, actually, maybe usually when they do it in a script, people will, you know, something bad will come to them because mm-hmm. it's not the right thing. In other words, this doesn't fall into the easy Hollywood morality.
Mm-hmm.
He usually it's like, oh no, they do that, and then everything goes to shit, and in the end, you know, everything goes bad, and they die. I mean, granted, in the script, he died, but you never want Clarence to die because you know deep down that he's right.
Yeah.
And as you mm-hmm. said, he wants to do what we all want to do, and he knows how to. He's even, you know, he's even got Elvis in his brain telling him, you know, killing him's the easy part. Well, no, killing him's the hard part.
You know, you could get into an interesting discussion about hero archetypes,
yes.
and anti-hero archetypes.
Go ahead.
But really, Tarantino, I don't think ever has heroes per se. I mean, maybe Kill Bill is an exception just because of, you know, that really was sort of set up as a samurai movie kind of thing. But people do stuff that you would want to do that you think is just, but you don't really see them as a savior. You don't see them as a hero per se, you know, or even as an anti-hero. They're doing stuff.
Early 90s techno. Oh, man.
That yeah. back room looks like the Two-Faced side of the
this thing
room
is,
in Batman Forever.
This thing is so crazily overlit.
Yeah, it's really.
Yeah, you're right. It looks like Batman and Robin the way it's lit.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the leopard print.
Yeah. I mean, if you read, once again, in the script, it's just like it's a room. It's just like it's dingy.
Mm-hmm.
That makeup is really nice.
Oh
yeah, yeah.
I like the eye
very
too.
Effective.
I don't know what they did to the eye. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where it's cloudy.
Yeah, and the and the scar over the brow and the teeth. the whole makeup's really nice.
Teeth is a riot.
The teeth are great, too. I mean, they really created a whole character.
Yeah. I mean, this is such a small part for him, but he does such a great job. Really, it was two scenes. It was the scene before and then this one, and that's it. And actually, in terms of structure, what Tarantino did with this, which others it failed to do or didn't do successfully, I don't want to say fail, but is that he was able to essentially introduce characters that appear just for like one scene, one or two scenes, are memorable, and then you move on. In a way, if you want to look at archetypes, in a way, like a journey, because usually in classical screenplay structure, you want to introduce characters early on, then you know, you want to plant them, and then you want to have them pay off, and you want to have them recur, and then show up again, so it makes sense why they're there. Here, he's here. It's like we accept it. It's just like Elvis. He's there. Or even when Christopher Walken's character shows up, it's just like one. They get their scene, and then they're gone. And you don't need to have anything more than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting that they got all these great famous actors to just come in and do one or two scenes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you hook actors to do stuff like that from the script.
Yeah.
It's from writing.
Oh, but this script is a great... I mean, that's what I would say. Right. It's like it's a great play because theater is for actors.
Right.
And this script just feels like, oh, I want that part.
Right.
It's
and, like, you know, 30 seconds of good acting is money. So much more money than even, like, 10 feature films where it wasn't that good.
Yeah.
You know? So that I think that's why these big actors are always willing to do these little roles.
And look at that look on Clarence's face. He's like... And now basically he talks him back. You know, he let him say his shit. And now like Clarence all had it in his head. He knows exactly. He's well possessed. He knows the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been paying attention to it. And I think the envelope thing is brilliant. You know. You know, here's the envelope and it's empty. That means
that's awesome.
It's like I'm walking right into you. He just has no fear with the techno going on in the background.
Sorry, Charlie Brunson.
He knows.
Yeah, Mr. Majestic.
He's
oh
a movie
God.
Guy, too.
Right.
Yeah, of course. Well, who didn't know Mr. Majestic?
Just him flying through the air in his underwear with the leopard print.
Into the pile of VHS videotapes.
Yeah.
Oh.
I like the hat.
Right?
Well, on top of the dreads, yeah. What he's doing is he's sticking his thumb into his mouth.
And ripping his cheek?
He's trying to twist his cheek.
He's fish hooking him.
And then basically he busts the guy's nose behind him, yeah. I think it's a pretty inventive fight. That's the interesting thing. It's in the script.
Yeah, it's a nice fight.
Yeah.
Oh!
Nice.
The fish tank is not in the script. Him getting punched in the face and then in the nuts is oh man. I just, you know, it's interesting watching it again. I don't remember exactly what it was like, but just watching this back, you know, 93, like, what? What is this?
Yeah,
we don't see this. And that's what makes it so great. We don't.
Right. It doesn't feel formulaic, and it doesn't feel like it's too structured.
You feel like you're watching a fight. Like
right.
A
you feel
fight.
Like you're watching
exactly.
stuff happen that, you know, you just happen
and
to be a fly on the
wall. And it feels dangerous. Mm-hmm. Like anything mm-hmm. could happen.
And that's the whole quality of the Tarantino scripts. Even when you're watching the ones that he's directed, every single moment, if you watch Pulp Fiction, if you're watching Reservoir Dogs or Kill Bill, it's always a matter of something, you know, you wait for that moment. That's where he twists it to the moment where something's going to break out,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly the same. Well, which is the same kind of, I don't say tempo, what it was that was in this scene, but it's diluted a bit by the way it's shot. That's the whole thing. That's why it's important about how it's shot to not take away from that rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But actually, Natural Born Killers, they captured very well. Like the beginning scene in the diner.
In the diner,
like,
it's terrifying.
You're just waiting for it to happen. But that's in the script. And that's what makes it great.
It's structured. It doesn't happen by accident, yet it seems like it is.
It's a great sense of suspense, brilliant. And it's a really good understanding of
Ride him.
That's right. I like that. Yeah, never turn your back on Clarence. Oh.
Ooh, that hurts.
Oh, man. So that's 5 shots. And this is, of course, he's done the... Oh, man. See, he tells him to open his eyes. It's just... Okay, he just shot 7 shots.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
However, yes. I did notice that when he was putting the revolver in the bag, it didn't have the traditional fluting on the cylinder. So they do make 7-shot 357 Magnum revolvers with that barrel length.
There you go. It is accurate.
And when you take when you take out the fluting, it makes it a full cylinder, and you can stack one more round in there.
Ooh, okay.
It's today's tip from your Uncle Dunk.
Good to know.
It's good to know next time you need to do that.
Next time I need to shoot a pimp.
Yeah. Take the 7-shot one.
Yeah.
That's right. Never 6, because he's going to expect 6.
Right.
And there's going to be a 7th.
Right.
That's a really good strategy.
The Valentine's Day tip.
That's right. I like it. I think it's sick when he says, this is the best hamburger I've ever had in my entire life. It's like he has no remorse about what he just
reminds
did.
Reminds me a lot of the scene in Pulp Fiction where they go in and kill the guys. There's also hamburger eating in that scene.
No, but the point is he killed the guy and now he needs,
right.
he needs to
like
eat.
It's like he's celebrating life, kind of. You know.
Well, yeah. It's like he feels, unfortunately, I hate to say it, he feels more alive, but it was Drexel.
Right.
And he was doing it to protect her.
Yeah, he loves his woman.
He loves his woman.
I think that's what keeps you watching this movie is they really do love each other.
Well, that's why, yeah, and she said, you know? Well, that's the whole thing. It is, I mean,
otherwise it'd just be people shooting at each other and taking cocaine.
That's why, I mean, I think this is really appropriate for Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
This is about a love story. It's about them. It is true romance. I mean, it's about their love for each other, and that carries all the way through the film.
And I think that's the parallel to Natural Born Killers, too.
That
no matter how disturbing
so
it
much.
Is, they still love each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I hate them. I like these guys.
Well, you like these guys. But Mickey,
these people are much more relatable.
Mickey and Mallory.
Comic book characters. That movie.
Well, but I think that was the intention, too, that they were more comic
book. Sure, it was intentional. I'm just saying you can't relate to that, really, as a human being, like you can to these people.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, it definitely, like, as soon as she's, like, so romantic and they kiss, I'm like, wow, that totally takes me to Natural Born Killers. Like, it looks like something that happened that.
Yeah. And now we get Dennis Hopper. Now we start getting introduced to him. Yeah, I don't mind this structure. I don't mind the way this is. I mean, you know, the script was one way. I think this works. Yeah, I think it works better now because, you know, we know the roots. We've seen their love. We've seen what he's done to prove and protect their love. And now we get to see everything else after that. So when they meet him, you know, the father, it means something.
And, you know, sidetracking a little just to talk about actors, I love it. It just occurred to me Dennis Hopper has been a part of a lot of, like, sort of, like, beginning film revolution kind of things. I mean, he's in this. He Easy Rider, of course, is a long time ago. I mean, and
Rebel
he was in.
Rebel
Without a Cause.
Speed was also as bad as we could talk about that being, it was kind of, you know, it was a kind of a shift in things, you know, to the more mindless.
Joss Whedon did
thing.
Do a rewrite on it. He did do a rewrite. Joss Whedon.
Of Speed.
Mr. Whedon, yes.
And they made it?
Excuse me?
Did they do his...
Are you saying they
filmed?
No, he came in and did a rewrite on Speed. He was one of the people who did a rewrite on Speed.
Right, but you're saying it was made into a film or it wasn't the rewrite?
Yeah, it was part of what they did.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I thought you meant like after. Sorry.
No, it was in the process of it being done.
We'll see if he had just done the whole thing from start to finish. Then.
Well, it wasn't his original idea, but they brought him in. Oh. That's okay. It's like Toy Story. He was brought in later on Toy Story. Yeah, he did a rewrite on it, too.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yep. It's a little Joss Whedon trivia for a Quentin Tarantino written film. Here you go. He's just like, what? Wow.
But look at how much he communicated right there just by looking at her.
Just looks.
Yeah. A lot of long lenses. I don't know how I feel about it, but it is. It's just the style. It's all right. I think it works for some things.
Side note, Doggy Daddy reminds me of, and ironically that Tarantino's involved in this, my girlfriend's taken to calling me Honey Bunny. She hasn't even seen Pulp Fiction, but she calls me Honey Bunny. We don't knock off restaurants either, but
oh, good.
That's next on the agenda.
Because that was my next question.
No, of course it was. Logically, I mean, that just progresses. It's interesting that he takes a very traditional approach, like to the whole idea of marriage and everything, and just, you know, family in a film like this. But he's not like the bad guy. He's not causing a problem for the, you know, protagonist that we like. You know, he's a guy. Like, again, it's like a real person, you know?
Dennis?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the character he's
definitely
playing. It's like a real person.
He seems very much more real than most of his characters, actually.
Yeah, I would go with that. He plays screwballs more often than not.
Yeah.
I like Christian Slater in Hard Rain.
I haven't seen that in a long time.
Wow.
Hard Rain.
That was random.
It wasn't a good film. Come on.
And may I just say that I like his hat.
Oh, his hat's awesome.
Nothing says manly like a...
Now, you see, Duncan, you've got a haircut like Christian Slater.
Yeah, kind of.
That's
huh?
your haircut,
you
dude.
Yeah. Should I take that as a compliment? Or?
I think that, you know, I dare I... Sure. Is this Christian Slater's best role?
I think so.
I think it's the best written material that he's ever had to work with. So.
And he's connected to the material.
He's into it.
Yeah.
And it's like it feeds him well, and he feeds it back well. Well, what I like about this character, and he's a strong character. He's self-possessed. He's just like, I'm doing what I'm doing.
And there's the bongos again.
Your favorite score.
Yes, it is.
What's with the bongo?
why they're doing that?
Did the bongos work here?
Wait. Bongos isn't the right word. What is it? It's a steel drum.
I forget the name
of the instrument.
Calypso.
The bongos?
Are the bongos working for
is
you,
it
Taylor?
Calypso?
Bongos. It's an instrument used in calypso music, yeah, but...
I don't know
if that counts as calypso per se. I don't know music.
The virgin is back.
The virgin's back.
The blushing bride.
Oh, that's right, because he asked for chicken. He can't have anything. Dick Ritchie.
Oh, for crying
that's
out
right. Concha. She's on Two and a Half Men, Conchata Ferrell.
Wait, who is that?
Conchata Ferrell. She actually was on L.A. Law in the 90s, and now she's been on Two and a Half Men she's done lots of other stuff. She's great. Great character actress. You do watch Two and a Half Men, right?
No, I do not.
Obviously. How could you not?
How could you not?
Oh, Anyone who's an American watches Two and a Half Men.
Come on. Exactly. I love this.
Speaking of cocaine, Charlie Sheen.
Right. And
going back to that.
That's right. Yeah, I like how this is. Actually, this is for a film called The Return of T.J. Hooker.
This is, by the way, the smartest like casting office setup that I have seen, because she's got a camera on him that feeds to a television behind him, so it's not distracting to him, but she can see how he looks on TV. That's brilliant. I've never seen that.
That is good. You know, when we go into our next career and we do casting, that's what we're going to do.
Yep.
That's not a bad
I'm going to remember that.
Dude, it could be truer than you think.
Hey, you never know.
I like the camera's off to the side. I think I don't even remember what kind of camera that is. Oh, that's... Wow, she can do one-handed...
Well, she put both hands down.
Yeah, she cheated at the end.
She started well, but
Jim
still.
Can do it better. Right, Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't do that. Ah, yes, Blulu Boyle. What a great name. Huh.
Next question is, what's Blulu going to do?
Well, that's where the film goes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, your bongos.
The calypso drum.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But am I right or what? Do we really need to have the Cancun? We'll call it the Cancun music. Do we need the Cancun music?
I think it's overdone at this point. Well, I can see twice. But it's been too soon since the second time.
I don't really understand
what
the message is.
And it's just like the same three measures of music.
Right. Right.
Here's what it is. They're putting the music in because it's like they feel like the material is, it's not enough to carry you through, so we need to kind of like liven it up with a little flashy lights and color and everything in the form of the music, and that just gets you to kind of ride along, and we get you to the next point.
Well, but I mean, is it going to tie us into when they eventually get down into Florida? Is that what that is?
No,
they go to Florida?
No, they wind up in Cancun.
Cancun, yeah.
Oh, they actually do wind up in Cancun.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is
the music that plays at the end of the film.
Oh, I guess that kind of makes sense, too. Like, this would have felt like a longer dialogue, like a little too long, if there hadn't been something else there, maybe. And that music in a heavy scene like that, at least for me, it makes me like look for something else that's not there. Makes me kind of, I don't know, extrapolate maybe some emotion behind it or something that isn't obvious. And even if it's not there, that's what it makes me do, and I don't think about how long the dialogue is.
Well, that's the thing. I think, once again, lends to the optimistic sense of where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And it fits also with how this is shot. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's shot really quite as they're making, you know, Detroit as attractive as possible on a gray day. They have the pink car, they have the blue trailer.
Right. The pink car almost looks drab, actually.
Well, it's a dark pink car. But...
Now, if you never saw this character again, you could still have a movie that would. I mean, I love the fact that he comes back and that he's pivotal, but I just like that bit of interplay between the son and father and the and the new wife. I thought it was nice.
That's Michael Rapaport.
What else has he done? I can't remember.
This was his first big role.
Hmm. He does a lot of TV now.
He's done a lot of work.
He does TV now. He did a lot of independent film. He was in a big independent, at the time. Some independent film where it was him and he had an African-American girlfriend of some sort. It might have been, it was right around the time of this, either right before or right after.
He's not a favorite of mine. I actually got to say I don't find him particularly easy to watch.
Well, he does a certain thing, and that's what he does. well, he was on Prison Break, actually.
Yeah, Prison Break.
He was good in Prison Break. He was good. I mean, it was a good role to, you know, to have. What's he doing? What's he doing?
Well, clearly she's stuck in the booth and he's trying to help her get out.
Oh, is that what he's trying to do?
Yeah.
Oh, he's trying to get her.
Unfortunately, he has to take her clothes off to do it because they're caught on the sharp edges.
To get her out of the phone booth?
Inside the booth, yeah.
Okay.
This would be the honeymoon period, wouldn't it?
It is. Now, I mean, I get what they're doing and everything. I find the hyper, well, it's not cut that quickly, but the hyperkineticness that they're trying to communicate with the music all playing and everything kind of bugs me. I'm like, it feels a little showy, so let's like covering, like, well, we don't know quite what to do here, so let's do a lot of show. This comes up later on in the roller coaster scene, which I think roller coasters naturally can shoot really well. It's like they make it too, they kind of overcut it a little bit too much.
Well, originally that was supposed to be at a zoo, and Tony Scott thought it didn't have enough adrenaline, so they shot it at a roller coaster theme park thing.
Oh, well, there you go. I mean, the roller coaster I thought was an interesting thing, but even then, we'll see when they shoot it, it's just like...
Poor Serge. His sense of artistry is offended.
Here's Michael Rapaport.
This is what Film Rock's about, looking at it, you know.
You're getting it there, okay.
I got it over here on the intertubes.
Ow!
What?
Yikes. Well, I think Gandolfini just like...
He got punched in the head.
Punched him?
Yeah, he got punched in the head up against a pistol.
Oh, Michael Rapaport, he did an episode of China Beach. Oh, one of my favorite TV shows I've ever.
Hmm.
What was the film?
I think the film was Higher Learning.
No. Oh, I don't know what it was.
Okay, so you were telling us before that Robert Forster was up for this part?
That's who Quentin wanted for this role.
Vincent Cacciatti.
Yes, but Tony Scott wanted Christopher Walken.
I'm going to have to go with Tony Scott on this one.
Yeah.
I think Robert Forster could have done it. Christopher Walken.
But he just brings that. He's scary.
And he's
without crazy.
Trying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This goes back to what you were saying before, and this is where we really start getting that whole sense of like anything can happen. We had a bit of the sense with the scene with Drexel, and actually I'd forgotten about that, definitely. And then we go back to the whole thing. You're like, you know something's going to happen, you just don't know when. And in a way, it's like being with an animal, a wild animal. You know, you're like, are they going to attack? Are they not going to attack? Which is, I think is really a good part of Mr. Tarantino's writing.
Well, and you see that in the thought process of Dennis Hopper in this scene too. He knows they're going to hurt him, so he tries to piss them off so it's quick.
Right. Right. Not quite yet. There's one moment where he realizes the gig's up.
Yeah.
Can't remember what it is.
Well,
look at this. He did the fake.
Not during the scene, but after the scene when I first saw this, I was like, wow, that was like a scene of noble self-sacrifice that you would normally only see in maybe a period piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't see that kind of thing, but he clearly makes a decision at some point, I'm going to die to protect my son.
Right.
And he does it, you know? Yeah. He takes action to make that happen. And, talk about a modern incarnation of a very classic, you know, mythological plot device. It's really very moving scene, actually.
Yeah. I think it's when they cut his hand. I think that's when he's just like, okay, I'm not getting out of this alive.
That's when he's sure what's going on.
Yeah. I just like how the Cacciatti or Christopher Walken just twists the whole story into what he says, you know, that they came in and they ripped him off. It's like, furthest thing from what happened. You know? Everybody, two people.
Emphasize that word.
Yep.
Christopher Walken is the best. He is the best. And then, of course, the next year he did Pulp Fiction. So I'd like to see him do another Quentin Tarantino film.
Have you seen him do a movie called The Funeral?
No, I think I've heard of
it. Where he plays a mob boss in like the 1920s.
Oh, really?
He's amazing. You got to see that movie. He's amazing in it.
Is there a film that he's in that he's not amazing?
Very true. But
there may be some. What about the Adam Sandler film where he plays the crazy scientist? I don't know. You didn't see that?
I did not see that.
Guys? I think it's called Click. Where Adam Sandler has like a remote and he can replay different parts of his life or something or change a channel.
I think I missed that dumbass thing.
So Christopher Walken had the mad scientist role. But you see, the way it's interesting, Dennis Hopper does such a great job because you can tell that he's bullshitting.
Mm-hmm.
The way he's behaving like I'm telling you, like I'm lying.
He's not used to doing that. He's clearly not practiced at it. But that's brilliant acting.
Well, I think it's, yeah. And he kind of, James Gandolfini pre-Sopranos.
Wow.
Right?
He's like a...
Yeah. Okay, this is where he cuts his hand. Oh, man.
And then he pours some liquor on it. Just tosses him a rag. Here you go.
Whoa.
That guy.
What? Don Vincenzo. I like how the subtitle says nothing. What does he say? Vincent Sir?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think in one version of the script, there's a scene with Christopher Walken and the mob boss, and Robert De Niro was supposed to play him.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Wow.
And here we get the whole thing about the lying, the pantomiming. Well, the pantomime. Which I think this is brilliant. I mean, of course, well, I heard about how once Fisher Stevens, I don't know, it's something, Fisher Stevens and this other actor just literally, they did this scene. And Fisher Stevens did the Christopher Walken part. You know, they just acted it out.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to do this. This is the scene we act. This is theater for us.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what this is. This is theater. I still think this could be done as a play.
For sure.
Really?
Totally. You make it all interiors. I mean, it does pop around a little bit, but totally. It's going to totally play as a play.
He's almost like...
You don't have to overproduce it.
I love this part. He's actually almost like going with the civility now. He's almost acting like he's going to let his guard down. It's like, okay, fine. Can I have one of those, and he doesn't call it a cigarette. He says a Chesterfield, he's giving respect even to the cigarette.
No, because he doesn't smoke anymore. No,
yeah.
He doesn't smoke. And the guy did call it a Chesterfield before. He says, you want a Chesterfield? He says, no, I don't smoke.
Well,
but he's smoking because he knows he's going to die.
Right.
He knows he's
and
gonna,
it's kind of like a telegraph that he's
making the decision.
If they were paying attention, it's like your last cigarette before you get killed. It's like a firing squad or something, but.
Well, he's trying to piss him off now so that he finishes him quickly.
Right.
Well, he's trying to piss him off because he wants to basically get a dig in on them and basically fuck them up
before they
kill
him.
Because he knows they're going to kill him anyway. He's figured that one out. You see Christopher Walken's brilliant here. You're just like, huh?
Yeah, coming in. Yeah.
And beautifully played. The timing, the pause, the use of silence.
Yeah, and not over the top.
And also the way it's set up. I mean, they're not moving the camera. I mean, really, they've got it's over the shoulder,
they're,
over the
stillness,
shoulder.
Stillness,
they're letting
two
great actors do their thing.
Mm-hmm. This is like Heat.
Yeah.
This is like the diner scene in Heat between
and you're right,
De Niro and Pacino.
They could totally just sit on chairs in a black box with nothing else and do this scene, and it would be captivating.
Yeah, staging it for the theater would be a little different here because it's harder to capture because literally you can't have him, just profile. We could do it. It's just different.
But look at Walken process this information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, man.
He is just an out. And in 93 to hear shit like this. You were like aghast. Like, really, someone is actually saying this?
Right, right. It's like, this is going to be a funny story later.
Also, of course, you can hear the music in the background.
It's almost like the angels are waiting to welcome him home or something.
I can't remember what the piece is, but it is an opera. It's from an opera, but it's from an Italian... they didn't have to put that in. The fact... I don't mind it. You know, you'd think
no,
you would
like
need it.
No, I like that choice.
Yeah, I think Tony Scott was a good, really good decision. I used to know what this was, and I forgot.
I think he uses it in the same one in The Hunger, too. Same piece of music.
Really?
Yeah.
In where?
The Hunger.
Oh, which we're going to do in the future, by the way.
Right. Right, I borrowed that from you.
Are you in? You in?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Oh, man. And this is brilliant. That's great writing. Mm-hmm. Because he takes this whole story and then he wraps it right back to the beginning. Am I lying?
And look for those 17 tells.
And then he's right. You didn't... You're an idiot because you claim to be able to do something, and I'm basically insulting you as deeply as I can.
Right.
Because I know what's going to push your button. Oh, man. If Christopher Walken could just have parts like this all the time.
Here we go, Kiss of Death.
That's right. The character actor, the mob guy on the left that we saw before, he's been in several other things. We don't see him there. Yeah, right there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what his name is, but he's done other things. Oh, man. Yeah. He just keeps on shooting. Oh, man.
You're like, okay.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
That's right, yeah. Don Vincenzo, that's right. Oh, man. And then, of course, the irony of it all. It's on the fridge.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Been there the whole time.
And now we're in L.A.? So basically, this is the midpoint, you know. So now we know they're coming. They've arrived in L.A. and that's the second part of the film.
Interesting. They're driving from west to east in that shot.
Yeah. Details. Only if you're from here would you realize that.
They do that a lot in movies, though, where they're driving through Malibu to go to like East L.A. or something
that. There's some great things when they drive out of the. Out of the motel, they drive it because the motel is in Burbank. I think it's on Olive, the Safari Inn.
Oh yeah,
and then they drive out. And it's like a street down in Hollywood. I'll show you this. I'll show you the shot when it happens. This is later when she's gotten beaten up and he pulls out. I like that she's got a yoo-hoo, quite frankly. And guess who?
Like the pink leopard print leggings.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, come on. I like the blue, the blue fluorescent bra, the turquoise fluorescent bra she's been wearing. And basically, that's all. Brad Pitt. Floyd.
What is smoking next to him? Oh, it's incense.
Dude, he's like totally smoking pot.
Yeah, that's why the incense is burning.
Oh, I didn't see the incense. I just saw the... Anyway, never mind. Now, you see, this is where the film kind of changes a little bit, because then this kind of kicks into... Before, I was like, semi-realistic. Now becomes more unrealistic, but maybe that's because it's L.A., so I guess it's okay if it's an L.A. type of thing.
They start commenting on the industry. And
yeah, well, the whole T.J. Hooker thing is just like, you know, I mean, it's basically a takeoff on a skit that was on Saturday Night Live.
they went from Hollywood Boulevard right into Burbank.
Yes.
Okay, that was part of it, exactly. That's right off of Olive.
Actually, it was Sunset Boulevard, I think, but...
No, well, it's somewhere in Hollywood, yeah.
Well, the theater in the beginning, the Vista's in L.A., that's not in Detroit.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What is it, downtown L.A.?
I don't know exactly where it is, but I do know it's in L.A.
I'm so, so disappointed.
That's Sunset
Vista?
Junction.
Wow.
Something like that, yeah.
Now, Junction. In the script, this is where we picked back up after the whole flashback sequence. So. Oh, the film that's on TV? That's Free Jack.
Oh, Free Jack.
Free Jack with Emilio Estevez and Rene Russo and Anthony Hopkins, which actually, while not a very bad performance by Mick Jagger, is what I would consider one of the truer cyberpunk, if you're into cyberpunk at all, science fiction, one of the truer cyberpunk films that were made.
Sure.
You know, it didn't cheat on its cyberpunk roots, so to speak. Someone kind of knew what they were doing when they made the film.
A couple of months ago, I was looking at that going, I should watch that. I haven't seen that in a long time.
I should watch it again. I mean, Mick Jagger truly is horrible. Oh. He is atrocious. He's a great singer. Sir Jagger, is he a sir now?
Did he get knighted?
I don't know.
Is he been knitted? But, horrible. But, yeah, it's I mean, if you're like into William Gibson and Bruce Sterling, that kind of thing, yeah.
Now, didn't he just do a great big nose full of whatever that powder is?
Maybe that's why he's behaving like this.
Maybe.
I guess. But I like how just Clarence comes in and he's just like, well, let's just unload, you know, all of this. And what the hell? And at this point, I'm like, oh, this is kind of where I was a little disappointed. It's like, well, what is Clarence? You know, Clarence is being unrealistic. He doesn't really know what he's doing. But then you see later on, He can figure himself his way out of anything. That's the interesting thing. And they never really exploit that, but it's just kind of the way he is. In a way, he's kind of a Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Written by Quentin Tarantino.
he was kind of a Quentin's take on Ferris.
Only not as good at influencing people, apparently.
I don't know. Give Clarence enough time. I think he could do anything. You know, it's interesting when you think about it. Has he ever done anything before Alabama like this?
Oh.
I mean, do you get that sense? Or is this like where he actually blossoms because he's got Alabama?
Maybe that's true.
I mean, maybe that's why he loves her so much.
He never would have occurred to him. Yeah, he was working comics. You wouldn't even know. I mean, he did have a 38 snub nose, but.
357, seven shot, Smith & Wesson.
I thought I had it right. Never mind. It's a 38 snub.
But you can use 38 special rounds in 357.
38 snub nose in the script. That's why I thought of that. Oh. He had a 357 seven chamber special round gun stuck in his sock. But
you know how heavy that gun is? That gun is incredibly heavy. Can you imagine carrying that in your sock?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
That wouldn't work very well.
It's a chunk. You'd have to have big socks.
Oh, that's interesting. They just had the roller coaster on there. Oh, that's where she gets together. Okay, that's where she says that.
Although maybe if you stuck the barrel in his shoe a little
film,
bit.
Film-wise, just I'm fine with it being here as opposed to the zoo. I get it. I can see the zoo being written, blah, 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 and the lines and all that kind of thing. And you can, not very suspenseful, but good old Bronson Pinchot.
Wait, save the gorillas?
He wants the gorillas. They're animal crackers.
Yeah, he didn't want him to eat the gorilla.
Right, because he wants to eat the gorillas himself because he likes the gorillas.
Oh, I thought he was just making a comment about saving gorillas.
No. This is how much. See, this is an interesting thing about Clarence. He's a child. Also, it's like he's an adult, but he's a child. He wants the gorillas. You know, like he likes the gorillas, the rabbits, and you know the leopards. That's what it was. He had the animal crackers at the zoo.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's interesting. I'm gonna have to read this some more.
Isn't that the same guy that played Serge in Beverly Hills Cop?
Did you not get my reference during the credits when I said speaking of?
No, that was too subtle.
Yeah,
sorry. You know.
Let me tell you, I was working at Errol's Home Video at the time, Errol's Video Store, and everyone loved looking at my badge saying, "Oh, hey, Serge, I'd like whatever it was, espresso with some lemon." I'm like,
and for a brief time, everyone pronounced your name correctly.
And I was like, that's not funny. It's like because you don't think I've heard this before, like a thousand times. They're all like, it's funny.
All right, how many times do you think I've heard Dunkin' Donuts? Just
have I ever said
guess.
It once?
No.
Okay. I like getting back to him, but getting back to Clarence.
I never really thought about
touché.
That, but now
I love the story about that he makes up, that is that's a cop. I think it's brilliant. I mean, granted, it is the writing, but I think Clarence, I can see Clarence actually thinking this up, and he knows the whole bullshit. He's got the whole line down. Now, this is great, but okay, so we see this, getting it, fine. So far, that's fine, but okay. Do we need all this? I'm not getting it. I'm not getting
it. Okay, yeah, you're over it?
I'm over the roller coaster. It's like we could have cut out of it already. If the point is to make Elliot throw up so he's more amenable.
Okay, now I'm bored with it.
Well, I mean, if the point is to show that Elliot is uptight and wound, you know, wound tight, then it doesn't really make sense for the character.
Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. All it does is it makes him want to cry and it makes him want to puke.
And look at the cup.
I love his sweater.
He exploded. Because that's something people ask every day.
That's right. And I like how they're all like eating and drinking.
It definitely sounds like Tarantino writing, though.
Well, yeah.
There you go. Oh, look, his sweater got cleaner.
Oh. Oh, man. Anyway. I always thought Bronson Pinchot, when he was younger, before he did Balky on whatever it was, a show that I hated, I always thought he was a really good comedic actor. I mean, yeah, he was good in Beverly Hills Cop. What he had done, I think he'd been in something else. Just really, really good actor. And I'm sorry he never had a bigger chance to make a bigger career. He was just really solid, just really committed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can go with that.
I like how Clarence just knows everyone's how everyone does their business.
Mm-hmm.
He is Ferris Bueller. Damn.
Yeah, actually, I'm going with that. Did you notice that the sweater was cleaner for the close up than it was for the wide shot?
It's
a mild continuity error. There's the great Saul Rubinek.
Oh, that guy.
Great character actor.
You know what I remember him the most from?
What?
Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Oh man,
he was a smuggler guy who had this really wicked disruptor that made you take a full 10 seconds to die.
Oh wow, that's bad. And he's just played so many things. He was just many things. He was good in a film that I actually called Family Man. He's really good.
Oh,
in
yeah.
that.
Mm.
You like Family Man?
The Nicolas Cage one?
Yeah.
It's all right.
I think it's a good Christmas film.
Yeah, it's a good Christmas film.
I mean, I'm not a big Brett Ratner fan. But I like Family Man. It's in a way, it's kind of a warped It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
It's Family Man? Oh.
I think I wanted to, but then too many people said it was bad.
I think it's worth seeing.
You guys
totally.
Like it?
I don't know why
check it out.
You'd think I'd be the one to say, with everyone, yeah. Mm. But I like it.
All right. Check it out.
It's got, I want to say it has morality hidden in it.
Hidden. Subtly.
Yeah, it does.
So this is the guy that's supposed to be Joel Silver, a Joel Silver type?
I don't know. He's a big-time action producer. Look at that, you killed. So he says, but so bottom line, I'm not Paramount. I love this. I want to open Dr. Zhivago with you. I love it. But I like the writing is great. You know? He's using basically talking about movie distributing as selling drugs. In code, which is great. I'm sorry. This is great.
So how does he...
Great dialogue.
How does he come up with this stuff?
He's Ferris
Bueller.
He's just
charismatic.
Well, and he's a movie guy.
I mean, he knows about movies. He knows about comics.
Yeah.
He knows about all that stuff. And he's a smart
inventive
combine
that with No Fear, I guess that would do it.
No Fear Inventive.
I think he just feels like he can get out of any situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can never get too bad because he'll just figure it out.
Right.
Exactly.
And clearly the no fear is based on complete ignorance of reality, really. Because he doesn't...
And that's
if he really had a grasp on what he was getting into and what he's done, it probably wouldn't be so...
I mean,
confident.
He left the address on his father's refrigerator, thinking that they weren't going to find that.
And that's...
Something about sharpest tool in the shed, I don't know.
Well, exactly. But that's the suggestion also with, Elvis is that... He's got a bit of a screw loose.
Right. Good point.
You know.
I wish they brought Elvis back more than just that
twice.
One time.
No, he's back later.
Oh, he's be like that.
He's back in one more scene.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In the hotel room, right?
No.
In the bathroom?
At the Ambassador.
Oh, yeah.
Right before the shootout. Calling on Sunday.
So now he's got to bide his time until Wednesday.
There is no Beverly Ambassador. They actually shot at the Ambassador Hotel back when it was around. They actually used it. Actually, I worked on a film where we shot at the Ambassador. It was kind of cool. I was in the kitchen. We shot in the diner part, and I went and walked around. I saw the different ballrooms. I walked in the kitchen itself. You do know why the kitchen's significant, right?
I was listening to the dialogue.
Well, at least if it's the kitchen, I thought it was. The kitchen is where Robert F. Kennedy was killed.
Oh,
at
yeah,
the,
yeah,
at
yeah.
the Ambassador.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's a good bit of trivia.
Unless that's the different kitchen. I thought it was the kitchen. I mean, unless they close it off. But anyway, it was weird.
I remember Brad Pitt's character. No.
Oh, Floyd.
How did he get out there?
Who? They flew out there. They took an aeroplane.
Oh, that's cool.
Across the country. Man, Gandolfini. He was recently in a play talking about the theater. He was in a play called, what's it called? That won a big Tony last year. And he was in the Broadway cast for it.
Who was?
Gandolfini. Mm. And Marcia Gay Harden. Oh, why am I blanking? Anyway, it's the same woman who wrote the play Art, which had a character by the name of Serge. So, of course...
Art, where their friend, like, buys this piece of modern art,
that's
and
blank.
It's, like,
that's
white.
It's
yeah.
white, yeah. And one of the characters is named Serge, and she's actually a French writer.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really big hit in France.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so, yeah. So
there's
one
a
guy
film.
There's a film called Art?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It's a French film.
Ah, très bien. Yeah. I can watch it because I know the French.
Yeah.
So is this the same place that's in Burbank?
Yes.
Yes.
You can drive it. It's on Olive.
Oh, I know. I see it regularly.
In fact, I once had to go there to check out something.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's a long
story.
What
kind of something were you checking out at the Safari Inn?
I had to look for a room for a producer and checked out the Safari Inn to see if it would be adequate for him, and it wasn't, and whatever, and stupid, and blah-diddy-blah-diddy. Okay, rule number two, never leave your newlywed bride alone.
No.
Ever.
Certainly not if you're in an action film slash drama.
Well, you have to know what movie you're in. And I don't think he knows. He doesn't know what movie he's
in. No, he thinks he's in Ferris Bueller.
Yes.
You know what? I think he does. Well, no. Ferris never blew Drexel away.
No, look. He just said what movie he's in. Bullet.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. He said, we now return to Bullet, already in progress.
Well, then there you go. He's in Bullet now. I think he's in different movies. He was in Ferris Bueller at some point. He's in Bullet others. I never caught that.
It's funny.
I know. Doing this is really cool because you get to like pick up a ton of these details. Oh, this is a creepy scene.
Right?
Yeah.
Creepy. Once again, it goes back to the whole thing of the suspense. I mean, if you watch it for the first time, you're like, what's going to happen? I've seen this a few times, so I know.
Well, and when I first saw this movie...
And you were 12?
Yes. I had never seen a scene like this where a guy beat up a woman so brutally.
Yeah. Mm.
And it was shocking to me.
It is very horrible. It is. So when your dad found out that you watched this?
Well, he didn't find out. That was smooth.
Oh, very good.
Plays football.
Yeah.
Because that makes him
bulletproof.
And now
he's going to leave. Yeah.
Oh, well, in that case. Man, she is dumb. She is dumb, too.
Right?
Well, I don't know if it's dumb, but it's just like, she's got balls.
Who would ever be calm with a guy coming into a room with a guy with a shotgun?
Well, she doesn't want to act guilty.
I'm sorry, but I have to say, I take that back. She's got balls because she just came in and she's just being cool. So
or she's just kind of dumb.
No, she's not.
No, I don't think she wants to act guilty.
She's not. She is.
Well, yeah, but
not
at the same
dumb.
Time, she at least a person dumb. Who wasn't guilty wouldn't act that calm either. They'd be like, holy crap, who are you and
but
what
knows,
do you want?
She knows he knows.
And well,
she,
right.
She knows she...
She's not quite clever enough to really act like she doesn't know why in the world he might be there.
Right, but then of course, you know.
True.
And of course, she's dumb enough to do this.
Right, right.
And he's just like, every time.
Oh,
Oh, is he, you know, he's singing Hello to Hollywood. Hello for Hollywood. Oh, hooray, wait a minute. Hooray for Hollywood. Oh, man. Oh, that's right. There's mirrors on the ceiling. That's what helps her out. I'm sorry. She's got balls. She totally does.
Well, because she takes a beating. She doesn't.
Completely does.
She doesn't talk.
Talk at all.
Ugh. Yikes.
Nice blood work there. That looked nice.
The makeup effects are great in this. Two of them. Oh, he's getting for both of them. Okay, that's right. He's getting food.
That guy's great looking.
Oh, that's a great cut. Yeah. I mean, it's horrible, but it's great. Yeah, I was always wondering, why do we have to keep on seeing him at the hot dog stand, or at the hamburger stand? But I mean, that's exactly the point, is to build a suspense here. Oh, she's crazy. Oh, man. I like that last little, ugh.
Oh.
And this guy.
Who is that guy?
He's the character you see.
He looks familiar, but I can't say I've ever.
He usually plays bad guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Is that Indian music playing in the background?
Oh, nice.
Cut to.
I think his name is Gregory. Gregory Sporletter.
Is it?
Burger stand customer.
Oh, that would be him then.
Starred in Sheryl Crow's video, All I Want to Do.
Was he in Black Hawk Down?
He's in True Blood.
Plays Calvin Norris. Is that right?
True.
He was in Black Hawk Down.
He played Galantine. Yeah. Very. Ooh, Taylor gets a gold star for
that one.
Galantine.
Nice.
Okay, this I didn't. Well, you know, now you hear this speech all the time, but at the time you'd never heard a speech like that. Never heard anyone talk about this. And she's like, oh, he's speechifying. And all I'm doing is I'm looking for a weapon.
Right.
So what is he talking about here?
He's talking about killing somebody. So the first one he threw up, and the second one is a little harder. Third one.
He's trying to get in her head about...
No, he's like, I don't...
He still wants her to tell him where the coke is.
Do you think he's getting in her head? I think he's just...
He's letting her just hurt for a little while.
He's not letting her... He's just trying to tell
her... I don't think it's working. What I'm saying is I think he's talking this way to try to impress upon her the fact she's going to die. Think about she's going to die, and maybe she'll finally tell him.
Exactly. That he's got no problem... killing people, and this is why he's got no...
Right.
I mean, it does give some dimensionality to the character, granted, and the way it's done now is just, it was made cliched in the 90s after this. It's like, everyone's got to write characters like that.
Right, and I'm sure that... I'm sure this was probably key in him being considered for the role in Sopranos.
Oh, no doubt. This is the biggest, you know... Well, I mean, I think... He got it already because he was a good enough actor to pull this off. Because this is a pretty meaty role.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Even though he has small screen time, it's still weighty.
But he's got more screen time than a lot of the other big stars in this movie.
That's true.
Actually, Tom Sizemore's called Cody Nicholson in this film.
Cody Nicholson?
Yep.
Well, there's... Yeah. I read somewhere that originally he was supposed to be Gag Daddy.
Oh, okay. So. Well, possibly. Oh, man. And this is, once again, you're talking about misdirection. It's like, come on. What is she doing? But she knows what she's going to do. What a pig. Oh. Oh, man.
That would hurt.
Oh, Elvis. And it just barely, oh, man, look at that makeup effect.
Ugh,
oh, man. Yeah. Oh. He can do evil really well.
Well, yeah, you believe he's capable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Clarence, what's your problem?
Oh, God. Oh.
She's great.
Okay.
Oh, man. Oh, there you go. She's thinking. She's thinking. Ah. And a one and a two. Oh, here comes the toilet lid. Oh.
Oh,
that's solid.
And man. That will crush oh. your skull.
That that didn't do it because he still gets up and he's got the gun. And but it's the aerosol can with the match that will burn the crap out of
him.
It
was flammable.
And
on him.
It's the aerosol. And here she's
listen
just,
to the listen to the banshee screaming.
I know. She's just yeah. she is just insane now. Ugh.
Wow.
Now you
talk
see.
Talk about primal.
Yeah, I was just going to say survival instincts.
Bam.
Bam. Mm-hmm. Hang on. And she's, oh, man.
Bam.
And just, it, and, but you see, this is cathartic.
Mm, exactly.
And all the energy that was built up, it's cathartic.
Ugh.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
And that's, I mean.
Let's beat the hamburger.
But that's what's key in drama. That's the whole thing. That's what Greek, you know, the Greeks were all about. They were all about catharsis. And that's what drama provides.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're actually going to deliver the violence, you actually provide the catharsis. And that's what this kind of writing actually delivers. Mm-hmm. And this kind of directing, quite frankly.
Well, and I like in that scene, too, the whole time they're kind of setting you up for Christian Slater to come in and save her. And she just
right.
takes care
she,
of it herself.
She, right.
True. No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But also, nice. But it emphasizes also that because he was away, well, I don't know. Because he was away, he let her... You see, this is why he's pissed. He's pissed because he left her alone.
Well, and there's finally been some consequences for his decision.
Right, true.
But also there's some consequences for him leaving. My point is that there's it's not about... It's about their love and not necessarily the plot. It's that he should not leave her alone.
Yeah.
Even to go out for food. It's like, you know, we're going out for food, which is part of the whole thing about true romance. You should not be apart. You should be together.
Yeah, huh. Mm.
And if you get apart, what happens? Your woman gets beat up, but she can't take care of herself.
Mm-hmm.
And
but that should not happen.
No, it shouldn't.
Well, exactly. Oh, man. He is such a douchebag. I'm sorry. He really, really is. Oh. And you see what's great about that is that there's just no getting away from the consequence. You can't play it any other way than just like, it's done. That's good. But that's good writing. Mm-hmm. It's good. It's succinct. Like boom.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's the guy. Oh,
yeah, there you go. There you have Chris Penn. So Tom Sizemore is playing Nicholson, and Chris Penn is playing Dimes, and then Michael Beach plays Wurlitzer.
I love this casting because they usually play either tough guys or straight out bad guys. You know, not so much lawman.
Yeah.
Know?
Unfortunately, Chris Penn is no longer with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chris Penn was pretty talented.
He was really good.
Speaking of The Funeral, I think that's his best performance. He's in that
movie. Oh, he's in that too?
And he's amazing in it.
Wow. I need to see
Ed,
that.
Ed Lauder? Funeral. Ed Lauder's in this? As the police chief. That's great. He's correcting his grammar. And now the whole Clarence's lie is now perpetuated amongst the cops.
Right.
Great fucking movie.
And you know, Chris Penn, of course, was in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
By the way, random reference. I really liked Chris Penn in. What was that name of that movie? It was a martial arts film. It was way back in the day. Best of the Best.
Best of the Best.
Yeah. It really had a lot of heart. It had Eric Roberts in it, and a guy whose father was one of the big people who brought martial arts to America for the first time. R-H-E-E. June Rhee was his father's name. Anyway, Chris Penn was in both that film and the sequel, and just a couple movies I grew up with. First movie has a lot of heart. It has James Earl Jones in it too, actually.
Did you ever see Close Range?
I don't think so.
That was with Christopher Walken.
Yeah, and Sean Penn.
And Sean Penn. Hmm. Yeah, right. He and Sean Penn played brothers. And Madonna did the song. What? That's when Madonna was good.
Didn't she and Sean Penn do a movie together called like
Shanghai Surprise.
Yep, Shanghai Surprise.
Oh, I saw some of that. Ooh.
Painful.
Yes.
Now you're going to go watch it again, though, aren't you, both of you?
They tried. They tried, and it's just...
No.
It's not what you expect, but... Oh, man, she is messed up. Oh, we're getting the Cancun music again.
Yep, Cancun.
Oh, yeah. There it is.
See, I've always seen on TV what other countries would look like. It's all of his references from media. His world reference is media. Well, a lot of it. Not the .357 Magnum with seven chambers in it.
Look at that makeup she's got on. I mean, great swelling. And...
Yeah,
because so many times in movies, people get just annihilated and they have like just a couple drops of blood.
Right, right. Or the swelling, I think, probably is the biggest thing. You can fake that with shading, but still, sometimes it's overlooked.
Yeah, see?
And that happens.
See that look there? He's just like, I cannot leave her side.
Mm-hmm.
He's got that smear of blood on him.
See, nicely done.
But what I love about that is that they actually took the moment, like, leave the camera on his face, and you get to, you know, it, because it is his story.
Yeah.
Floyd.
Absolutely.
Brad Pitt, man, doing his bit part. And this is when he was just starting to get bigger parts. I think he'd done Thelma and Louise already.
Yeah, I think he had.
It was Sunday before.
Are you following timeline?
I am.
Damn.
It was Sunday before, and now...
It's Wednesday?
Oh, well, is it already Wednesday? That's my question. Are they about to go over to the hotel right now?
Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. Okay, a few days could have gone by.
Yeah, well... Okay.
See, this is the thing that doesn't make sense in this film. His audition is the worst.
Right,
and he still gets the part. And he, I mean, at least if he was just a doofus like he is, but at least he acted well... I could see it. I don't know.
It's always funny to me the idea of showing an actor struggling with their craft on a film.
Brad
like it's just, you know,
an actor who obviously auditioned for
right,
this part.
They auditioned, they got a role to play an actor who auditioned and got a role.
You know, and actually you made me think of this. What I like is that no one's a smart ass in this film. Who's? I don't think anyone, even Clarence, who is essentially Ferris Bueller in a perverse...
We're going to stick with that.
I don't know. I'm just trying to reach for something. But even Ferris, well, is not a smart ass. Whereas in a lot of what I'll call the imitators of these kind of films, everyone would turn into a smart ass of some sort, or a lot of people would, because it's a cheap cop-out in terms of your acting choices, much less your writing choices. And it's kind of fundamentally misunderstanding what it is that, shall we say, the progenitor of all this. I mean, if you want to say Tarantino writes this way, wrote this way, and everyone tried to imitate his style, but all they do were imitating style, but they didn't get the core essence of where the characters were coming from, and missing it, making everyone a smartass in the process.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's easier to make basically smartass characters with pithy lines than it is to really
give
characters heart and make them real, and that's why they talk the way they
do. With heart and foibles, exactly.
Right. I see what you're saying.
I mean, even these two guys, you could say the two cops would be kind of smart, but you can tell already from the way they've been written, they kind of have a place to come from. Even, you know, Nicholson with, you know, Nicholson and I, he's got this thing about grammar. So already built into it are tiny little things.
Nuance.
Nuances, if you will.
Good, and backstory.
Good ratting.
Good ratting. Got some good ratting.
Good ratting.
Mm-hmm. And directing. I mean, credit where credit is due.
Yes.
The director did a really good job.
It has to start from the script. If you don't have a good script, then you're going to be struggling uphill. You can throw as much, you know, do as many magic tricks as you want. It will not string together. The directing helps bring it to life and absolutely is instrumental. And the actors. And then all the craftspeople. It all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
But some definitely have more influence, yes.
You're right, though. I mean, if you're working from a crappy script in the first place, there's really little you can do.
Yeah, it's an uphill battle.
Or a script that's not solid or not all the way through, or some things are not worked out.
Yeah.
And those things, betray themselves. Even when you're directing a play, your problems you'll run into are the parts with the weaker writing.
Mm.
You know? And then you have to, in the film, the idea is that you rewrite it so that you fix those parts. And sometimes dialogue will do it. Maybe sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's the structure. Sometimes it's the character arcs. And that actor is Michael Beach, right there. Actually, he had an arc on ER for a while. He played Gloria Rubin's ex-husband. Back in the 90s. I like how they lie to him about what it is that happened to her.
Mm-hmm. Okay, they're really overdoing the Calypso drum now.
Thank you. Oh, now.
Yeah, now I'm tired of it.
Now it's a problem.
Now it's a problem. The third time was a little awkward. Now we're on like time number 6 or 7. Now I'm kind of going, they could have used something else.
Well, because that's the only music they use in the entire film. There is no other than the source music they've used. Mm. They only use the Calypso music, the Cancun music.
Right.
There's been nothing else.
They are so pleased with her breasts.
I think she's pleased with her breasts. Oh, I like what he said also. It's better to have a gun and not need it than to need a gun and not have it.
True.
I've often Words used that analogy and compared it to seatbelts.
I've used it as an analogy with a bathroom. A wise man goes to the bathroom when he can, not when he should.
Yes.
I heard this.
Similar structure.
I heard someone say, and it was just like, you know, you're right. What? Fine.
We're talking about danger, Sarah, and then you went to the bathroom.
But seatbelts, everyone wears a seatbelt. Who doesn't wear a seatbelt?
Well, that's not the point. If you don't have a seatbelt and danger happens, you need it.
Everyone's got a seatbelt.
When was
If you don't
Beverly
have a gun
Hills
and danger
Cop.
Happens.
Thanks to who?
I said, when was Beverly Hills Cop?
Early 90s? No. 84,
88? Before.
73.
Before.
73.
Yeah.
52.
1960.
I was going to say.
No.
Actually.
It was early 80s.
This is interesting.
Little product placement there.
You know, if I ever need a negotiation, I want to get Clarence.
Yeah.
Right?
Clarence knows how to negotiate.
By the way, that revolver clearly has fluting on the cylinder. See the little divots?
Which means
that's
it's six.
Which means it's six at most.
Or Yeah.
So maybe, it wasn't
maybe
seven.
Five.
Maybe five even. For the size, more likely five. So it probably was a gun mistake earlier. Unless it may have been the lighting. I couldn't see it right. They do make them that are the seven shots, but they are bigger than that. And they don't have fluting on the
cylinder. Shooting seven. I like the fact that Sizemore Nicholson is just like, he's not going to shoot him. Then he says he's going to shoot him.
Yeah.
I think seatbelts are the result of Ralph Nader's work back in the 60s.
Interesting.
I think it was, yeah. I think that was one of the things they got implemented was laws for seatbelts.
Mm.
Oh, man. And it's interesting that Clarence doesn't get it. Well, I mean, obviously this guy doesn't give it away completely, but...
And Clarence doesn't get it.
No.
He's talking to somebody.
And Clarence is just like...
Well, on the other hand, when someone freaks out enough, they say crazy stuff.
Right.
You don't know. That's one step away from, you know, calling out to God and the holy angels to come and rescue him or something.
Okay, I don't like the directing this scene. All the hugging, too much.
Yeah.
Too much. Okay, we're done. We're done. Let's get out of the scene.
Well... Oh, Sarah, you get tired of things like that so fast.
I like this Clarence kid. See, even Sizemore Nicholson says I like this Clarence kid.
It's a honey bear.
Yeah, it's a honey bear bong.
It's a honey bear bong.
There's still honey in it.
That's what he had smoking on the table before.
Yeah, so it wasn't incense.
It wasn't incense. It was pot.
Residual smoke.
Yeah, I like this how they just come in, hey, with guns.
He's like, oh, you guys got me.
Dude. And he's like...
I was surprised.
He's like disconnected. Well, he's, right? Everyone keeps on asking Dick Ritchie. But he knows what's going on. You're asking directions from a dude who's stoned.
I think that was an insert.
That was something they went back and shot.
Oh, I can know this will be funny.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did.
Freaking brilliant.
It wasn't. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I wasn't so sure about that. It's like, this is not a funny scene.
I mean, they could have done the same thing with silence.
Exactly, which I think probably they had before. It's like, yeah, I don't know. But then again, I'm not Tony Scott. I'm just a guy who does film grok.
Is that Apocalypse Now they have playing on the screen?
No, he explains what it is. But it's supposed to look like it.
Oh.
Oh, strangely,
Lee is a little too happy to see him.
Yeah, eager to see them in.
It's like, what do you pay me for?
Of
Be nice.
That is awesome.
And nicely executed way to allow him to keep the weapon.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Put it right out in the open.
Put it right there. Yeah. Yeah.
Because just the shut up, I'm doing business now, that wouldn't have worked by itself. That would have been
a little
it wouldn't,
yeah,
it wouldn't make sense. Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't make it too contrived. Oh, the dailies. Someday I'm going to have to find a way to use that line.
Well, Valentine's Day is tomorrow.
Good call, Taylor. I know you're hoping your special man says something like that to you.
So romantic.
Oh, it really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it came from a movie that says true romance. Yeah. I mean,
I stepped away. What was the thing that was said?
Deer Hunter is a great movie. That's what we were saying.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Which, of course, had Christopher Walken.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like how she's hiding her face.
That looked like one of those, like, you're almost asleep and some weird thing in your brain makes you have a spasm thing.
Yeah.
I know he was supposed to be excited, but that's what it looked like. Is that a coffee stirrer? What is that? Is it a blood drawing needle?
It's a glass, special glass tubing for snorting coke.
Probably silver.
I'm sorry.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking.
He pulls his hat down like that's going to help.
That's a lot of coke, man.
He sends Boris to make sandwiches and
that's
coffee.
That's right, Boris, and put down the guns. Aspirin?
Yeah, sure, get him that.
Now, it's interesting, in terms of just writing once again, how it could have all played out into one scene, but, you know, the instinct is there to even, to basically, how do I put it? To put into more of a crucible, and as I mean, to up the suspense, to say, fine, we're not being convinced, now really convince me, take everything away from the action, and it's just the two of them. I mean, they're using this whole thing where, like, they can't, you know, the buzzing of the, whatever, the microphone not working, but the point of it is that Donowitz wants Clarence to convince him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is more of the scene. If I had a chance to look at the script, because I didn't get to this part of the script, I'd say this was probably more of the emphasis than the whole thing of the cops listening in. I think the cops listening in is more of kind of, I don't want to say fake suspense, but more movie suspense.
Yeah.
Whereas the suspense in the story is whether Lee accepts the deal or not. That's the dramatic part. That's the part I'm interested in. I know.
Taking it out into this atmosphere, which is wonderful, a wonderful change.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just complete change from where they were a second ago.
Yeah, I don't care about Elliot. I don't care about the cops. I mean, it is emphasizing that their obstacle is definitely coming, you know, going to come rolling into the door. Mm-hmm. But this is where Ferris has basically got to sell the deal. I'm sorry, Clarence.
And by the way, I laughed earlier because we were laughing at the little note that she's writing him.
Oh, yeah.
So cool.
Yeah,
you're right,
so
in the
cool.
middle,
so cool.
With a little heart.
But that's really important.
He's doing like a giant drug deal with guys with guns. You're so cool.
But that's...
They're teenagers.
That's totally. The it's yeah. like the that's, middle schoolers passing notes
it's,
thing.
It's the true romance. That's what it is.
Right.
It's, see, she hands it to him.
And he's like, yeah.
He has to make sense of it all.
See, but at this point, I feel like, I don't know why I feel. I feel like
he's just losing it.
I feel like the love story has kind of gotten a little lost. Just a little. I don't know why I feel like that.
He's leaving her alone again.
You know, you're right.
He's got to go talk to himself.
Oh, yeah. No, he's got to talk to Elvis. That's very different, yes. Taylor.
He does have to go. Well, you're right. But he is leaving her alone again.
You're right.
You know? And it's not only that he's leaving her alone, but he's separating himself from her physically. It's when they get separated that something happened, that something
which
bad
is also
happens.
Very, very much like Natural Born Killers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Got to watch that again.
Similar theme.
That when they're apart, they get hurt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the whole love story, we have to physically stay together at all times or bad stuff happens kind of thing.
Wow.
But together they can overcome anything kind of deal.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, because they don't break out of the prison until they get together.
That's right. Boris is nuts. Come on.
Wow. That's what he gets for hiring killers. Jeez.
Seriously.
Well, they're basically mercenaries likely.
Oh, I hate
can't say there's much love for cops going on there. Wow. And then, of course, you got these guys coming along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Mad dog.
I guess it's their way of saying rookie.
Yeah, that's right. He is. He is the rookie.
Wow.
Uh-oh.
Oh, man.
So in terms of the editing, they have a lot of people to cover.
Oh, jeez, yeah. This would be a nightmare.
Totally.
And then what do you have? It's like Clarence in the bathroom again with Elvis.
It's a lot of wide shots, though.
Of what?
In the room. I guess you're talking about coverage.
Well, they were wider, but, I mean, this is all shot telephoto. Oh, there's long lenses. Everything's really compressed. Mm. Very shallow depth of field.
Yeah, that's true.
And it looks sexy. I mean, it always looks... Look, now you can see Val Kilmer the best. I mean, out of focus. And it's likely for legal reasons they didn't do this. And it's but it works. This works really well.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's great.
You've got the physicality.
It's impressionistic.
Mm-hmm. And you've got the voice, and it's enough.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things, like, if you show them, it's almost like it breaks the illusion.
Exactly. Yeah. And it reinforces that basically Clarence is a little on the nuts side.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to be nuts, you might as well see Elvis, you know? I like how everyone's...
He's like, may I be excused from class, please?
The classic wimp.
Saul Rubinek. It's great.
Why does he have that?
Okay. Oh! So he throws orange juice at him.
Hot coffee.
Oh, it's hot coffee. And he still shoots him? Oh,
yeah.
Wow. He just shot. That's... There you go. There's Nicholson. Okay, I want to keep track of the shooting. Who's shooting who?
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, he's...
Well, Bronson didn't do well.
It's cop out there. Boris shot them.
Okay. Now, they take too long getting back to Christian.
Well, that's... But now he's there. But you see, then Dimes shoots him, and they cut out him getting shot. Now, this is where... I guess when they shot it, Clarence is killed.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. And that's other guy. So his other guy's mercenary gets shot. And then Mad Dog is still shooting. And you got Chris Penn and... Oh, my God. That's okay. So Mad Dog gets shot.
Yep. Because he's dumb.
And then there's still Vic. He gets out. I think in the script there's something about him running into the other guy that gets out.
Which other guy got out?
I don't, the other Italian guy. There's another guy who's actually in the lobby who's taken a hostage. It's the guy that doesn't speak English.
Right.
Okay, so now this is important because this is the last guy, so. And he says it with an Italian accent.
Wait, what is that on his waist? Is that a target?
I don't know what it is, but wouldn't
it's
his,
white
it's,
and red stripes?
It's right
what
below.
Is that?
It's right below the vest. So in other words, he's not covered there.
Well, yeah, well,
that's intelligent.
Man, that whole feather thing. I cannot imagine trying to shoot that.
Ugh.
Cannot
what
imagine.
What a nightmare.
Can you just imagine for our art department? So basically here, Clarence is dead. And, okay, that's Boris. I mean,
unfortunately, they probably bisected his descending aorta.
Ah,
oh, is that what it is?
Yeah,
good call. Oh, he took a hit.
Oh, he took quite a few hits. See?
Oh, right under the vest.
Yeah, yep. And she gets up. Now, in the other cut, she shot. Okay, in the other cut, it was the Italian guy that got shot. Remember, you know, who shot?
The guy with the shotgun behind the couch?
Behind the couch. He's the one who got up, and they had him shoot him, not Alabama.
Oh.
That was part of the problem. Now, the way it's written much different, where actually she comes around, he comes around a corner, and she shoots him.
I guess I don't understand. Fundamentally, I mean, everybody's shooting everybody. How is it worse for her? I mean, like, it makes sense. He's shooting near her.
I know,
and she's
it doesn't make any sense.
Out of her mind.
For some reason, because she's one of the hero can't shoot the cop. I don't. I remember reading about it and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, oh, come on.
I think they used the phrase in cold blood, too, because he's not really going after her at that point.
Was that what it was? See.
So they felt like.
It was an unmotivated killing,
I
or
guess,
unjustifiable.
Like, purely vengeance, I don't know.
Everyone was shooting everyone else in this room.
Yeah.
Anyway, so on DVD they released, I guess, what they shot. But even then, it's still different from the script, so. And I guess that's a nice little diversion for them in the lobby so that they just walk out.
Right. Well, apart from his little bit of blood right here, like, they look pretty normal. It's just kind of staggering.
It's just like, yeah, oh, he's drunk or something like that.
Right.
Well, yeah, because they have no idea what's going on upstairs.
Yeah, like they just got caught in the crossfire or something.
Yeah, well, they just think that this is here. They don't know what's been going on upstairs. That's the ambassador, I think, yeah. It's been a while.
You know, it just goes to show, like, people really pay attention to body language to look for suspicious people.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked security at Paramount, that was a lot of times how you could tell someone wasn't where they were supposed to be.
It was body language.
Whether they looked lost or looked like they were looking for something or something like that. If you look like you pretty much know where you're going and you're not in a hurry to get there, you don't look suspicious.
Yeah.
You might even have a little, you know, something on your face. And,
okay. Yeah. Oh, you see, so now the Cancun music I'm okay with.
Yes. Now it makes sense.
Yes.
I agree.
Thank you. Like if they had only had it when Dennis Hopper talking to the kid and then back to this time only, that would have been okay.
Yeah, they just used it too many
times.
Yeah.
Well, it started to lose its emphasis, basically.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. She talks about you're so cool. It's interesting that they decided to do this. I don't mind that they decided to have Clarence live. It's a different end.
I wonder about the eye patch, though.
What about it?
Well, I mean, he was wounded above his eye.
Wow.
So it just seems a little weird. Seems kind of like, well, we want to have him have some sort of, you know, repercussion from this wound.
I kind of like it. I don't see guys with eye patches very often, so.
No, it's just, well, okay, then blow his eye out.
Well, I think maybe it was blown out. We just couldn't tell.
He was shot above it.
I don't know. Or he was grazed or something like that. Yeah. I don't need to know exactly what it was. It's just that his eye was basically badly, if not permanently damaged.
Well, and he may have been hit by shrapnel even, or pieces of glass from the bar, or something else.
But what I don't like about it is that once again, I think what you'd mentioned at the time is that it's like we haven't seen Clarence enough, and then he comes out of the bathroom, and then he's shot, and sort of like, because Clarence was the focus of the film, and here he became an unfocused, and then he got shot. Oh, Gary Barber, he's one of the new co-CEOs of MGM.
Hmm.
Oh, small world. Anyway,
Mentor, that's what he's credited as.
Who?
Mentor.
Val. Yeah, Mentor. There you go. Yeah, well, he is his mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nothing happened to...
Hang on, I want to see who the Italians were. Do anyone we know? Luca? It doesn't say Italians. Okay, all right. Yes, you were saying? Did anyone...
Oh, well, nothing happened to Brad Pitt.
No.
Mm-mm. Okay, good.
Yeah.
No, he's just a dumbass.
He's just
that they ran across.
He's just high. You know,
so
it's like, okay.
He tells them what they want to know, they go.
Yeah. It's not a dumb thuggish movie. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Dumb thuggish movies, you know, are
just shoot them for no reason and move on.
Well, exactly.
Not as much fun, not as interesting.
You know. I mean, these guys are somewhat sociopathic, but not that sociopathic.
Mm-hmm.
On the sociopathic scale.
I like the fact that Michael Rapaport got out of there. He's like,
yeah,
so now he's cast in a TV show. You know, he goes on after this to be
he's
in his
TV Hooker.
Show.
He's on T.J. Hooker.
Yeah, in the script, I think what it was is that towards the end, the script that I had in my hand, is he actually gets the elevator. He's pushing the button, and the other guy with the shotgun comes, and he like looks at him, and the two doors open. He says, and the Italian guy says, good luck, and they both dive into the elevator, and he just lets him go. It's like, I got nothing against you.
It's kind of interesting.
Got to get out of there. Yeah. Yeah, I think the probably the most restructured thing in terms of shooting all this, reading through this, was that last one.
I'm sorry. One of the grips was credited as a running cop earlier.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, continue.
Wow.
Same name as my sister, Hillary with one L.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Is that they restructured a lot of that last part. But you can, you know, actually, you can kind of tell the last part is like the least play-like of this whole thing, and it sort of like kind of goes into all the different directions. So we go to the cops and everything. We wanted to go back. Naturally, there was a desire to go back to Clarence.
Yeah.
So I think the efforts to kind of tweak it took away from, I think the natural creative juice that was originally there. Does this make any sense?
Yeah, I did, you know, feel like, something was missing, like, not seeing that. It's like, wait, what just happened? Like, I see him falling on the floor.
I mean,
he fell on the floor.
For me, when I feel that something feels out of sorts, it's usually because of the original, I guess, the creative thrust that drove the whole thing before. When you try and adjust something, it's like, well, you've got to adjust other things to make it all work. And if it's not organic, then it starts betraying itself as to why things feel kind of like a little out.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going for entertainment value, but then there's something about it, if you're discerning, or if you want to be discerning, that just kind of feels a little off, and I think that's what I'm picking up.
I'm trying to think what would have made that ending a little better, as if maybe Clarence wasn't, you know, taken out with one bullet at the top of the gunfight.
But that's the way it's always been in the script.
No, I know that, but I'm just saying,
gunfight.
I'm saying, I find that a little dissatisfying.
I bet you anything, once again, I wish I'd gotten to that part, and I wish I could talk more about it. I bet you anything, the gunfight itself is maybe, we don't know very much about it. It's probably in the bathroom, and he starts hearing the gunfight out there, and he has no idea how it all started, and then he comes out into it, and then blam, he gets shot, and then it kind of shifts focus. I don't know. I'm going to take a guess that maybe there was more emphasis, because you're right. We were with Clarence, and the mentor in the bathroom is like, well, where is he? I want to follow him.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And then suddenly he's out of the fight. All this gunfire takes place. And I liked her seeing him and crawling to him and trying to revive him. I liked all that. I think maybe if he had come out and engaged in the battle, or you know, somehow tried to get, you know, been worried about her, somehow more engaged in that whole scene, because this guy that we've been following through the whole film is suddenly not in the climax. You know, he's been hit and he's down, mm-hmm. which is, you know, obviously realistic, but I found it a little dissatisfying.
And it felt disconnected.
Yeah.
Also, the way they shot it, if you notice, oh, here's, you see the shot, and then you just see, you, I'm sorry, I'm trying to act it while I'm, you see him.
Doesn't work
with
microphones.
That was hilarious.
I'm away from the microphone.
You see his head just turn. You never see the hit or anything. It's sort of like you don't get any effect.
Or even who shoots him, really.
No, you saw Chris Penn's Dimes shot him.
Which actually, I guess does sort of motivate her shooting him.
Right.
But it's very disconnected.
It is disconnected. Yeah. And the way it was shot in long shots. So, I don't. Once again, how did they put the scene together? And how did that all come out, and why did it come out that way? But I think they were also battling the whole thing of she can't shoot. He was supposed to die.
He was supposed to die.
And she can't shoot the cop, which is what they dealt with the release, which is probably the MPAA who said, no, you can't shoot the cop. And they had to go back and they changed it. And then when they went back to the DVD, which is, you know, what we're watching, or the VHS at the time, they said, fine, let's put in the ending we did want somewhat.
I don't mind her shooting him. I think that's fine. I actually kind of wish he would have just said something like, you killed my husband, or something that would remind the audience that he's the one who shot Clarence.
It does go by very quickly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow.
Yeah. Well,
because I didn't make that connection enough.
I don't want to say, you know, once again, I'm not criticizing totally, but better directing?
Well, all in all, I think it's a pretty well-directed film.
Well, no, but
clarity in the scene.
Clarity in the scene. It just becomes all fireworks and hyperkinetic, and you lose track of who's doing what to who.
Right.
And that always the challenge is clarity, is you want to know, this is why this is happening. Even if it happens fast, it needs to be clear, this is what's happening. Oh, that's why it's happening. And you don't have to take so many leaps to, what just happened?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you know, we pointed out at the time how much of a cluster that would be to shoot and to edit. You know, just so many people and a confined space and everything. I don't know if you can peg it exactly on directing. I mean, it's just...
You have to put it together. I mean, you shoot it how you want to shoot. You shoot here, you shoot those guys, you shoot those guys, and you shoot... You know, you figure out your coverage, and you figure out how to tell your story. You break it down enough so that it can make sense.
Mm.
Without crossing the line too severely, which
is you keep on moving the line.
Yeah,
but you have to. But also the way they shot that, I'm sure there's a lot of things. Oh, let's have him shoot that. No, let's have him shoot someone else.
Well, one thing's for sure, it'd be hard as heck to go back and
have
do
feathers.
Reshoots or pickups or anything in a scene like that.
You do it
with all those affectations.
You do it. You match it. You figure it can be done.
Okay.
It's always possible.
Possible.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Not easy.
But that whole sequence, that was 2 weeks.
For the gunshot.
I'm impressed.
For the whole scene. I'm going to guess it took at least 2 weeks.
Oh, you don't know? You're just guessing?
I'm just going to guess. But that whole gun scene, probably a week.
Can you imagine going to work every day?
But lots of stuff. I mean,
for a week, we're doing this scene.
A lot of pyro.
I'm tired of seeing feathers.
A lot of pyro, yeah.
Yeah. Gun safety and stuff, like just keeping track of props and all that. I mean, yeah. Mess.
But in terms of the guns, the stunt people and everything.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of that, the squibs.
Can you imagine your script supervisor trying to keep? I mean, what a huge task
but that's
for
what
a script
they do.
Supervisor.
Well, they do.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. But
huge.
I mean, wow.
Huge.
They may have even pawned off some of it on second unit. Quite frankly.
That'd
in terms
be tricky.
Of some of that stuff,
you'd have to.
It could be
you'd
tricky.
Have to map this out to the T.
No, but that's
that.
Fine. You hit second unit, you know, you just coordinate with your second unit director and say, "This is what we need. What we need." They get it. That's fine. That's what their jobs are.
Yeah.
As long as
I
you
guess
have
the
access
hardest
to the
part
set.
To me seems like it'd be the feathers, because that like it gets in everything and just you know making shots.
Yeah, I mean, it would
match.
Be a pain in the ass.
I bet you the argument would be that you just. You know, it's sort of like smoke. Get a lot of smoke in there. And okay, feathers. Get a lot of feathers in there and just make sure it's there. And it also helps the cover in terms of, I think it's...
And a lot of those
visually, it's very interesting because it's a little brilliant because it helps to give you something moving in your image all the time. Once it's moving.
Which also helps mask any covering of the line.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It's like smoke. It's
in
only
some
a little
ways
better.
It might
because,
have made
well,
it
even
easier.
Better, yeah. Even better because your screen direction is always this way. You know,
right.
even if you tilt the camera to the audience, they're going to understand the screen direction.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he tends to use a lot of smoke in scenes, but I think that was very interesting putting in there. I think it's a little annoying, but it's okay. Because
yeah,
it,
I mean,
it wouldn't have been better.
It's
an artistic affectation which works, but it's sort of like, it's arty.
Yeah.
And I like art, don't get me wrong. But sometimes I don't want art.
I just want
my guns. I don't want my shooting.
I just want my guns and my squibs.
Winter's gun shooting and squib. I don't think I want some art. I don't know. Or you can make it purdy, because it's always easy to make something purdy. But sometimes things shouldn't be purdy.
We should watch some John Woo.
Mm. Somewhere along the way, the killer will pop up.
But not Mission Impossible 2, please.
No.
Okay, let's talk about let's talk about that really quickly, because that relates to this a little bit. What I didn't like about Mission Impossible 2, maybe it'll match up with you, they never showed a gun hit, ever. They edited out, in other words, so I shoot you, and then, you know, by the time, you know, I see you, you'd never see the squib. There were no squib hits whatsoever on camera.
And that's a little...
And I was like, this is a John Woo film. And it's a Mission Impossible film, and there's guns. I want to see my squib hits.
Yeah, I'm paying to see the damage.
I'm paying to see the damage, exactly, and there were none. I swear. Watch it. You please tell me. Report back to me. Tell me there's a single squib hit that's been left in that film. They've all been edited out, and I thought it was a piece of
I honestly couldn't have told you that there were no squib hits.
Milkshake.
Just thinking back about it.
Piece of shake?
Piece of milkshake.
Yeah.
Right. Shiitake mushrooms. For instance,
no, it just pissed me off.
Yeah, well, what got me about that film was the extreme, over the top superhero level stunts that they kept doing. It was just it was so beyond. Like, I understand, like, James Bond does stuff that's, you know, out of our experience, but it was over the top. But I'll have to watch it just to see about the squib hit thing. That's interesting.
But they kind of went away from the core. Well, we're on to Mission Impossible. They went away from the core because we're never going to do Mission Impossible 2. The thing about Mission Impossible was is the team aspect. It's a team getting together and doing something, which they kind of touched on in Mission Impossible 1. Mission Impossible 2, all out the window. Mission Impossible 3, who cares? I mean,
I liked 3, actually.
Yeah, it was entertaining, and your doppelganger was in it.
My doppelganger.
Yes, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, please. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I worked on Mission Impossible.
I should be so lucky, actually.
I did security
not
for
a
them.
Look I want.
Okay, I'm not sure they're all
transpo, and I did background as well.
I'm sure they're all fine and nice people, but it was like at that point, once again, it went away from the whole thing of it being a team.
That's true. It did go away from the original concept.
Mission Impossible, it's about team.
But I liked
putting
the
together the impossible.
I liked
mission.
The movie itself. It was entertaining. I liked it.
The I Am Force.
All right, mm-hmm. But getting back to this, what was interesting about it, and this goes back to the Mission Impossible 2 thing, is when you're going to do violence, you do violence. And I think what Quentin Tarantino did with this first film, at least everyone recognized with the writing, is it really presented violence in a different way, in a dramatic way where you didn't know what was going to happen from one moment to the next, which has not always been around forever in terms of moviedom, but I don't think very many people can do it well, if at all, except for Mr. Tarantino, in terms of the writing, and definitely in terms of the depiction of violence, much less how much violence, and that violence is consequential, and which, of course, is really emphasized in the films that he directs, especially, you know, Reservoir Dogs, but especially in Pulp Fiction. You know, there's consequence to all the violence, and when someone knows to pull back from the violence and not do it, as opposed to more the brainless stuff, where it's just like, oh, it's just violence for violence's sake.
Right.
It's like forgetting what, because within all of this writing, at least earlier stuff, I'm not going to talk about the later stuff, there is a streak of morality, a strong streak of morality, which kind of strangely sneaks its way. Clarence has morality. He has a moral code of some sort.
That's what motivated him to go and start the whole business.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Defending his woman's honor in a way.
Right.
Absolutely.
Which
exactly.
is true romance, if you ask me.
Right. And she had morality. She didn't give him up, you know.
No, she didn't.
She was
talk.
Just like,
right.
So, I think that's, you know, I know it's been a long time since everyone's over-talked Quentin Tarantino, but he definitely came on the scene, and this was one of the first films to really bring all that out. And now it's more over-talked, accepted, whatever, and forgotten. But I think it's worth definitely coming back to this and seeing the roots of where a lot of this stuff was.
Yeah.
It's a good, solid film, I think. That last scene is the only thing that I find somewhat dissatisfying.
Yeah. Right. But I think that's a scene, once again, where they had the biggest problems, and that's where we kind of sense where all the problems come out. That and the Cancun music.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But it definitely holds up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Tony's
which is
did a
why
good
we
job.
Were all motivated to do this today.
That's right. So, how does this rate as compared to when you saw it at 12?
Well, I think I take away a lot more from the movie than Hope so. I saw it at 12.
A lot less black and blue, though, from Daddy.
a finer appreciation?
Yes.
She's just not in as much trouble.
Any new insights from this watching?
New insights. I think I just appreciate everything more. Mm-hmm. Their love for each other, the moral code, the mm-hmm. acting. Mm-hmm. You pick up on more things than when you're 12 and you're like, whoa, this is really violent.
Wow, scary.
This is terrifying.
Were you glad that you watched it afterward when you were 12 and you
got
done watching
it? Yeah, I thought
it
was great. I'd never seen anything like that.
Did you get in trouble for it?
They didn't know.
They didn't find out. This is the first time they're going to listen to this and go like,
now, wait a second. How many of the movies in the Forbidden Collection did you manage to view without being discovered, by the way?
Yeah.
Well,
were you ever discovered at all?
I also had this other little system. My parents were divorced.
System.
So I would tell one parent that I had seen it at the other parent's house, so then they would let me watch it.
And they would, of course, never check with each other.
No.
Someone needs a little bit of a refitting of her moral code.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Playing fast and loose with the truth.
Yep. Okay. Well, I hope everyone out there has had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Valentine's Day. Yeah. Okay. So on that note, I think that's it for this week's Film Grok. This has been True Romance, and this has been
Jim Usterman
and
Taylor Thomas
and
Duncan K. Fraser
and Serge Delpierre. See ya.